their presentation because they are doing a regulatory work. ESCOM presented a request to them, and they had to go through hearings all over the country, I'm sure, try to cover all the 9 provinces. I hope also reach rural areas because we are biased to towns, having them in Midland and all that, but it's an issue for later discussions with you. But you were able to go to the 9 provinces, I'm sure, and have hearings and hear concerns and issues raised. Then at the end, you have to come back, consider all those, and then be able to say, this is what you propose as NEFSA. So that is why then, Member Dex, I'm saying good luck for their presentation, because we've been waiting to hear the process, what led to this and all that. It is in that spirit, in the 2010 spirit, that they are going to give us good results as a regulator. But we're sure from the 2010 team, everything is on board in terms of energy and power. We even tested all the stadiums. They did a trial run. You just treat it, and then in 15 seconds, 20, 30 maximum, less than a minute, then the other system kicks in. So sure, we are on the right. You are doing a good job, NEFSA, I think, in terms of your regulatory work. Where you are doing right, you must say, yes, you are doing right. You can't go now. You can't go. You have to explain to us as the committee how you reach that. Because I think as said, the laws of the country and the constitution, NEFSA is within the legal framework to conduct these hearings and then be able to come to us after they finish all the processes. Hence, then, this is the first available time that they can come to us as a portfolio committee, because we don't have hearings like they have. We are not regulators, but we are people who do oversight work because they are an entity that reports to the Department of Energy. So in that regard, then we hand over, I'm not sure whether to the chairperson or to the CEO, to introduce the delegation and proceed with the long-awaited briefing or presentation. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. My name is Simunda Mukwe, and I'm the Chief Executive Officer at NEFSA. I'm taking this unusual step of talking before my chairperson, not as a disrespect to protocol, but given that this is the first time that the chairperson of NEFSA, who was appointed on the 1st of January this year by the minister, given that this is her first appearance at the portfolio committee, I should take that opportunity to present her. As you are well aware that the National Energy Regulator consists of 9 members, 4 of whom are full-time and they are appointed for 4 years, and the part-time one are appointed for 4 years, and the 4 that has just recently been appointed includes the chairperson, Mrs. Cecilia Kuzoya, who is the leader of the delegation this morning. So, Mrs. Kuzoya, on your behalf, can I just present Mrs. Sambani Bukula, who will be doing most of the talking, the member primarily responsible for electricity regulation, Zetima Kenji, who is the manager in the CEO's office, and our stakeholder management officer, Vanda Langehoven. Let me at this stage hand over to the chairperson.
Thank you. Good morning, chairperson, honorable members. It is indeed for me a privilege to share with you today on this task that was mandated to us. I need to paint the background first of where we were as a country when we received the application from ESCOM. Economically, we were in recession. We received the application in October. The application was put to us in October, and ESCOM applied for 35%. We were seriously in recession. And at that stage, economists were saying the recession is going even deeper. Okay? So ESCOM, we then took comments from SALGA and from Treasury, and then ESCOM revised their application. They handed in a second application on the 30th of November. Okay. Being in recession meant that we had to look at how do we as a country grow our economy. We also were still committed to the jobs that the president had said he was going to create. So we were saying, how do we as NERSA help ESCOM, one, the jobs that they have, keep them, but also help growth in creating jobs. We were also looking at, as NERSA, we have a responsibility to make sure that as a country, we can guarantee the availability of sustainable electricity. The chairperson has just referred to the 2010. We were saying, if anything, we cannot have a blackout during 2010. So that was one of the things we said, definitely not. We understood that ESCOM was behind in the infrastructure building program. But like all of us, we're South Africans, and we were saying, how do we help fellow South Africans catch up with what they had to do? And then we also had our mandate. So this is the background against which we found ourselves faced with the application. I will now go through the process of how we went about it. Okay. As I mentioned earlier on, we would have received the application in September, and ESCOM would have taken comment from SALGA and National Treasury, and then resubmitted the application in November. Once we had that, we obviously publicized, as per regulations, we have to do publicize it on our website so that we can take comment from stakeholders, relevant stakeholders. The comments were allowed until the 14th of December. We extended the comment for written submissions. At that stage, we had made up our mind that this is such an important one that we have to go out to the 9 provinces. We then advertised, and then we went out for public hearings right through the 9 provinces. And you can see the provinces we went through was Limpopo, we went to the Northern Cape, Kimberley, we did Bloemfontein, we did Rustenburg, we did Durban, and we had a full house in Durban. I think there were 6 buses that came in Durban with presentations. We were there the whole day. And then in Gauteng, we had to extend and have two more days. Yeah. Because of the presentation that people were wanting. The Western Cape we did one day. So it was, for us who we knew as regulators, highly educational, because here you were interacting with people who use electricity on a daily basis and the impact that this was going to have on them. Once we had got all of that, we then consolidated and we continued having committee meetings internally, but also taking into consideration. Now, between what I'm saying, the member responsible for electricity would have run, I'm sure, that the spreadsheets that they ran of different computations, starting with 5%. What happens if we give 5%? And he would run the goals. And he would, what happens when we run 7%? What happens when we run 8%? What happens when we run? And he carried on like that with these people for a good 3 months, I think. By the time we made the decision, you could see the young people that do the spreadsheets, they really were weary. That, members of Parliament, I really want to say to you, I'm sure he'll tell you himself, there isn't a figure we did not consider. I mean, we would sit and say, what about 7.5? You said 7, but put in 7.5. and recompute again, and they would do this. And he's blessed because the team that he works with, I suppose he's conditioned them well. We received no complaints from them. Didn't matter how many permutations we were saying. What about 6.5% here and 7? No, they would compute it and they would present it to us. We really are blessed, members of parliament, to have young people that have been developed up to that level that are also willing to do their work. Yes, and serve. I'd like to get back to our mandate on this matter. In terms of our mandate, Act number 4 of 2006, when we decide on regulation, we need to enable an efficient licensee to recover the full cost of their licensed activities, including a reasonable margin of return. Then our mandate for pricing, as I mentioned, we need to allow them to recover the full cost for the licensee, allow them also efficiency improvements on a continuous basis, and also we should include proper pricing signals to users. Hello? Okay? Avoid discrimination, but we also had to allow for cross subsidies where applicable. Later on, Mr. Bukula will show you how we've looked after the poor, of the poor in the whole thing. Yes, we had to look after, make sure that ESCOM was able to recover and build. But we also had to take into consideration Omar Dlamini, who stays in a village and uses electricity. In Natal, one of the people that came to present.
I said, where is that?
KwaZulu-Natal. KwaZulu-Natal, where one of the presenters came to present. It was a woman who's running a hospice, and she was presenting on behalf of the group of NGOs that are running hospices. And she painted a picture for us where she says she has people in the hospice that are on dialysis, and she has people that are different. And she was saying, I am so dependent on electricity that if you increase, this is the impact to me. And we, you know, we sat around, we thought, how do we protect these people, these particular individuals, when we make out this? So my member, Bukula, will show you how we have protected those people. But by the same token, we also had, as part of the presentation, big industry coming in saying, was very interesting. No, there must be a tax. So you say to them, thank you for telling us there must be a tax. So where is the tax going to come from? Oh, no. You must tax the ones that are profitable, not every one of us. And you realize something is not quite right here. But let me get back to our mandate for pricing. We also have to look, we looked at the revaluation of assets so that they reflect the replacement value that is prescribed. In terms of the residential inclining block, this is where everybody that uses electricity, ordinary household, this is where I think you will see we really took into consideration for the average person and for the poor of the poor. In terms of the hearings, a total of 427 stakeholder comments were received, and 85 presentations were made at the public hearings. And the stakeholder comments, more were from private individuals, small users of electricity, intensive users of electricity, government departments, trade unions, environmental groups, the NGOs, and other stakeholders. Stakeholder comments that we have summarized were as follows. People did not like the fact that the financing was going to come from the tariff. The impact on the economy was also another area where they were saying, what about introducing the tariff slowly, you know, starting off slow and then increasing. We looked into that too. Protection of the poor. We had people that came to the hearings with their electricity bills. And they would say, so if I add the 35%, this is what I'll get. It was one of the Ratepayers Association members, again in Durban. So if I add on to this is what I will get there. Now, I need to tell you, this is unaffordable because my salary is XYZ. So we also looked into that. The protection of the poor was important. The return on assets, the revalued assets, there was a concern shown on those, and we dealt with that. The NGO, there were people from the NGO sector who were looking at renewable energy, and they were saying carbon emissions on coal are not acceptable at this point in time. Madam Chair and members of the Portfolio Committee, may I now pause here and allow Uthembane to continue with the presentation. I will then come on later on. Uthembane.
Thank you, Chair. I think the Chairperson has painted the picture with regard to our mandate emanating from legislation and from the pricing policy. And now in terms of our rules, and we call them MYPD rules, which we have adopted after a similar process of consultation with the public. Now, simply put, these rules are saying we as a regulator, we need to determine and allow allowable revenue, and that allowable revenue is based on the cost of operation, that is manpower, OPEX, and all those kind of things, and then plus depreciation, return on the asset. That is why the question of asset devaluation was a main issue, because we were requested to evaluate the assets in terms of the replacement cost methodology. And, of course, there's what we call a correction factor. A correction factor is there to enable us to do a number of things, but mainly two things. One is to correct for the over-recovery or under-recovery over a period of 3 years. In other words, if the revenue was higher than we predicted, we would then, in the following determination, give back to the customers. Or otherwise, if the recovery was below, then it will be paid back to the licensee, and it also allow us to do smoothing. As a final point that I'd like to make, and I'm sure Mr. Bukula will make it very, very clearly, because one of the things that we have noted in terms of stakeholder representation, there was a repeated statement that says, so many people represent said this, but you never took into consideration what you said. Yes, number of people is very, very important, but the National Energy Regulator Act requires us as a regulator to base our decision on facts and evidence that are presented to us, and all those facts and evidence are presented under oath during public hearings. So it's not necessarily the number of people who will say, we don't want 10%, we want 5%. And on that basis, we would make a decision. We would make a decision based on the material conditions that are dictated by the formula, the legislation, and the formula that we have, so that we enable an efficient licensee to recover its full cost of operations plus a reasonable return. Then from that point, I'll hand over to Mr. Bukula. Honorable members, Chairperson, my part will really go into the actual numbers and the figures that were looked at in the multi-year price determination for the period 1 April 2010 to the period 30 March 2030. The slide that you are on now is slide number 8. That slide is a table that shows the first line is the revenues that were allowed for Eskom over the 3 years. The first figure in that slide being 85,180, that's in billion rand, 85 billion rand. Eskom had applied for about 98 billion rand in the first year, and I will just concentrate on the first year figures, and what we had allowed them was that bottom figure of 90 billion rand. Out of that, how they had applied for the 85, for the revenue that they required, as per the formula that was shown in the previous slide, they had assumed that the electricity that will be sold, which is then showed in gigawatt hours, would be 204,551 gigawatt hours. Now, this is the sales that they are projecting. And when you look at their figures in 2009-10, it would show that there's a growth of 5% between 2009-10 to 2010-11, and that comes from the fact that most of the smelters and the ferrochrome industry, during the recession, they had switched off most of their plant. About 1,000 megawatts was off the system in 2009 due to the recession. So the growth that you're seeing of the sales in the 204,551 gigawatt hours comes from the fact that there's a growth of 5%. In the subsequent years, the growth that is being assumed is a growth of about 2 to 3% in the sales. Now, when you take the revenue that has been allowed and you divide it by the gigawatts, that is, you then get the third line, which is the standard average price. This is the standard average price, which is averaging the prices across that. In the past, this price used to be very similar to the wholesale price because the figures were quite close to each other. But this figure is now the standard average price. It is not necessarily exactly the same as the wholesale price that the Eskom would have in their structural increases. Now, when you look at the first year, the price of electricity on the 30th of March was 33.15 cents per kilowatt hour, and that increase of 24.8 is then the one that brings the price to about 41.57. And the last slide really indicates that when you have taken the revenues and now you start to include the special pricing agreements, the international customers and utilities, the total revenue that Eskom would receive from its operations is 90,972,000. When we go to the next slide really summarizes what was allowed in the revenue. In the revenue, Eskom had applied for about 42 billion rand in the first year, in 2010-11, for their primary energy. What we have allowed is the amount that is shown there, 36 million, but then the figure of 36 million excludes what has been ring-fenced for the independent power producers and the coal generators and the renewable energy power producers that have now been included from the years, or the revenue that is required by them is included in the years 2010-11 to 2012-13. So in the first year, the primary energy is about 36 billion rand. The amount that is allocated for the renewable energy generators, the other independent generators, totals to about 12 billion rand over the 3 years. The operating expenditure is also close to about 100 billion rand, and the other amounts show the depreciation. The other figure on the return on the assets, I will get into the detail about the return on the assets at a later stage when we indicate what is it that we have given Eskom as a return in view of the legislation that requires us to give an efficient licensee an ability to recover the full cost plus a reasonable return. And then the last part is listed as the demand-side management. These are the initiatives that Eskom has to undertake if we have to ensure that, not just Eskom, in fact the whole country, if we have to ensure that during this period up until we get our first power station, we do not have power shortages. These are the measures, these are the amounts that are set aside for reducing the demand, either by being efficient or by moving the demand. using solar water heaters and other measures. Now, on slide 10, I go into the detail of what we have looked at in the primary energy cost. Eskom per annum, and I will only take 1 year because the other figures in the other years would make these tables bigger, but the proportions that I'm indicating in this year are similar in the other 2 years that have not been listed in here. Now, Eskom burns about 130 million tons of coal every year, and that costs about 24 billion rand. Now, in the way that they burn their coal, there are three types of mines where they buy their coal from. The first one is called the fixed cost mines. This is where they have a stake in the mine, and what happens is they pay a fixed cost for the amount of coal that they are going to buy, and that probably gives them about 40% of their coal. And those are by far the cheapest sources of coal. The second source of coal is the one called the cost plus, where the mine mines as a cost and then as another margin, which is also determined in the contract, that provides another 30% of to 40% of their coal. Then the last one is called the short-term coal. This is the contracts that they have that are for a year or two, and those happen to be the most expensive mines for them. So the reduction that you see in the middle column in red under adjustments of 480 million rand is a reduction we have imposed on Eskom from buying from the short-term mines. We have said that Eskom, in the past, you could buy up to 98 million tons from the combination of your fixed costs or your cost plus mines, and the other 20% which comes from the short-term, which is the expensive one. We accept that that is what is going to happen, but you are now going to maximize the amount of coal that you buy from. If you will buy all of the coal that you can buy. So they can buy 98 million rand. In the application they've given us, they've shown that they could buy or they plan to buy 95 million tons. So we force them to buy the full 98 million tons each year from the fixed cost or the cost plus, which then provides that savings of 480 million rand. The next big part is the open cycle gas turbines, which are located here in Ankerlech and Hoerikwa in the Western Cape. Those, we have only allowed them, according to the application, to use them when they are required, that is during peak times. Those generators are designed to operate only 5% of the time in a year, and we have also required them to have fixed contracts for the supply of the diesel so as to ensure that the costs don't overrun. And out of that, we have managed to then reduce their projected costs by 4 million rand just by optimizing the fuel costs. The next line that was there, which was big, I also have to mention that in the application they had requested an amount of 950 million rand to repair the roads that are damaged in the area where they transport the coal. And that we have allowed just to repair the roads for them to be able to transport the coal, but going forward, the repairing of the roads has to be done by the department that is responsible for repairing of the roads, and that you will have to, Eskom will have to pay a toll fee. And at the moment, what has been proposed is a shadow toll fee, and that's what the 950 million rand is for. Then the next line is called the SAP contribution for the 2010 World Cup. This was the contribution or the allowance that Eskom was making to ensure that during the 2010 World Cup, they can buy additional power from the neighboring countries. And the fact that we've removed 540 million rand, it is not to say that we are saying they shouldn't buy, but it is to say that that has already been accounted for in other parts of the application, so we've removed it from this part of the application. The one for the independent power producers and co-generators and the renewable energies, we have not reduced that amount by a cent. We have said it is encourageable that there should be independent power producers and co-generators. The next line, which is looks at the demand market participants, these are people who have their own generators that can generate electricity. But when they generate, they want to be paid by Eskom. Eskom had required 646 million rand. When we looked at the contracts that they currently have, we could only total contracts that go to about less than 646. So we disallowed the amounts that we did not see the contracts in. But we did not stop those who want to participate in demand market participation. And the last line really shows the environmental levy.
which is the levy that is paid on the amount of electricity produced via coal. And in that, we have just required Eskom to be efficient in the way they use their electricity in their own power stations. So they would have required 5.1 billion rand, which is said that it must be reduced by 31 billion rand to 5.68 billion rand, which is to say that Eskom in its own operations, because they generate electricity and use some of it in its own operations, we expect those efficiencies. So from the total that the Eskom had applied for, of 40 billion rand, we have reduced that by 1.2 billion rand on the primary energy cost. Then the next slide really shows the summary, and we will go to the next slide, slide number 12. Slide number 12 now looks at the operational cost of Eskom. First line being the manpower cost, the second line being the other operational cost, and then the third line being the corporate heads, like the treasury of Eskom and Eskom Enterprises. The figures, I will talk to the next slide, slide number 13, which really talks about the figures. In their operational costs, Eskom had applied for increases in their current or existing operational costs of around 7% per annum. That was disallowed and reduced to say that increases in your operational costs, and specifically your manpower costs, would be limited to inflationary increases, and the inflation figures that we are using are around 5.6%, and that's what we have reduced Eskom's manpower cost by. And the figure of 739 is that reduction from an increase of 7% to the one of 5.6%. Now, the second category, which is operating maintenance, insurance, cost of carbon, all that, in most of the repairs and maintenance, we have not reduced, but however said that Eskom, you are now going to ring fence the funds that you say you are going to use for maintenance, and you will ensure that when you report to us regularly on a 3-monthly basis, you show us if you have conducted this maintenance. It turns out that you didn't conduct the maintenance, then that money would be clawed back from you. On insurance, their insurance, Eskom currently uses the principle of saying that, which is used by most insurances, that when an item or an item of plant fails, a transformer or a breaker fails, then it would be replaced, but what they pay to the insurance is an amount that reflects that they would pay for the replacement cost of those. Now, the insurance amounts that they indicated had increases of about 11%. We assessed what the insurance industry's increases are around, and we then limited those increases to the inflation that we have established, that insurance premiums across the world and in the industry that they operate in have increased by that amount. Then there's a second part, which is called the cost of cover, where they buy most of the equipment that they buy abroad, and there's partly what is called the forward cover. And that amount, we have linked it to the contracts that they are going to place. So if they don't place those contracts, they are not entitled to the amount of cost of cover. And then the other bigger part was the one of arrear debt. In the way that you calculate the revenue allowed, you allow for arrears. So in Eskom's case, most of their arrears come from a particular area. 90% of their arrears come from a particular area. The other 10% is distributed across the country. What we have then said is that those arrears will not allow them to grow. All we would allow for is for the arrears that would come from businesses that are liquidated and some of the people that may not be able to pay, but not as much as Eskom had required. Eskom had required an amount that equals to about 8% of the actual revenue, and we have reduced it to just less than 4%. But having considered the fact that when you have the price increases, you will also have an increase in the non-payment, but having said that, if you look at the inclining block tariffs, we do not expect that the lots of non-payments would come from the same sources of people who have not been paying, hence that reduction. That then amounts to an amount of about 661 million rand that has been reduced from the other 16 billion rand that I indicated. Now, on the corporate overheads, that is their treasury department, the Eskom Enterprises, increases that were coming from that, we have also limited them to be increases that are inflation related. So the total savings from the operational expenditure was about 1.4 billion rand. So the next slide, slide number 14, shows that they had applied for 34 in the first year, and we have reduced it by 1.4 billion rand. So the revenue that they have been allowed to collect to deal with their operational expenditure is 32.66611 billion rand. Now, the next slide talks about the capital expenditure. In Eskom's capital expenditure, they are planning to build 10,000 megawatts or 4,800 and 5,000 with Midupi and Kusile. Now, the starting point for this very one is that when we have accepted that we are going to grow our electricity with the size that I gave in the slide, the first slide, by 204 to 214 to 236 going forward, then that growth cannot happen if you do not add 10,000 megawatts into the system. So the starting point is that 10,000 megawatts has to be added into the system to ensure that we grow, to ensure that we do not have the shortages of power, and to also ensure that going forward we create the necessary reserve margin that would allow Eskom to then go and operate, to go and maintain the other generators, because at the moment maintenance is becoming a difficult thing to do. The amount that Eskom had applied for, and I will use again the first years, but if you look at the 3 years, they had applied for 96 in the first year, 108 and 103. If you average that out, it's about 103 billion rand capital expenditure per annum over the three-year period. So what we did from that is we looked at the actual cost of Medupi, and we then removed what Eskom had included as capital. The first part that we removed is the one that is called interest during construction of 8.1 billion rand. We said we are not going to capitalize this amount. When we give you the return, you will get the additional revenue flows that would make you to be able to cover the interest during construction. And this I have to mention that it is a very important factor, because Eskom has always been on Eskom credit watch by Standard & Poor's and Moody's from January 2008. And one of the reasons why they were in credit watch was that the rating agencies could not really detect or see from what Eskom was being given whether Eskom would be able to meet their debt or their debt repayments. So when you provide them with a dedicated item that says that this is the amount that is allocated for Eskom to be able to pay for the interest during the construction and the other loans, then credit rating agencies look at that positively. On the day that the announcement was made, Standard & Poor's then lifted Eskom's negative credit watch from negative and affirmed it at BBB+, because the signals in the pricing determination were also positive towards what they normally require. So I'm emphasizing the interest during construction allowance, because it has that importance. Now, on future fuel, these are the amounts of revenue that are normally used for the coal that would be used on the, for the future mining processes, and this has been taken and used in the place that is normally associated with future fuel, which is the work under construction according to accounting terms. And we've also then removed the other capital expenditure that was associated with the corporate side, which is not the part of the business that is regulated. So which then really reduced what we have seen as the capital expenditure of Eskom from the 96 billion rand to about 79 billion rand, but without reducing the amount of power stations that they must build, because that is the point of departure that we all have to accept, that those power stations have to be built. When we go to the next slide, the next slide really talks about the second part, which is the return on assets. Eskom had applied for a return on assets using the electricity pricing policy. The electricity pricing policy says that the assets of a utility must be reevaluated using a method that, there are many methods that can be used, but using a method that would reflect the replacement cost of the assets. Now, the regulator is supposed to ensure that whatever evaluation of assets, they vet that and they verify that. But in this instance, due to the time constraints, the verification was not as thorough as it would have been required. We selected certain items, but we also used the fact that we've got 40,000 megawatts installed. And if you look at the replacement cost, it would come close to the figures that Eskom has given us. So what Eskom has done in implementing the electricity pricing policy, they have taken their assets that are currently sitting at around the 120 billion rand, reevaluated them, they came to about 600 or 485 billion rand. And then they started calculating a return on that. The return that they used for their calculations was around 10.03%, but however, when they had used that return, they still looked at the return on the assets that was negative in the first year, 1.1, in the following year, and 4.7. Although there was a return of 10 points that they had calculated, but they didn't use the full return. What we intend approved, so the amount that Eskom was going to receive from using the reevaluated assets was around 51 billion rand over the three-year period. But I also have to say that even if the assets were not reevaluated, if you start from the basis that you have to build the power station, if you do not reevaluate the assets, the first thing that would have happened is you would have had to have an increase of around 60% in the first year, 22% in the other year, if you are accepting that Eskom is going to build the power stations and those power stations are required. And with the balance sheet that they have and with the funding that has been given by the government. So as much as the reevaluation of assets is an accounting thing, it would not have changed the amount of increases that are required. All it does is it repositions Eskom accordingly so that going forward they can be able to borrow money on the basis of their own balance sheet. So what we have then done in the reevaluation of the assets, we have then shifted that. We have said that we are not going to reevaluate the assets over the three-year period of the multi-year price determination. We are going to allow the assets to be evaluated over a five-year period, so we are phasing in the evaluation of the assets. Hence, you'll find the difference between the figures that we have given to Eskom and the ones that they had applied to. They looked at it over 3 years, we looked at it over 5 years. We only started including the re-evaluated portion of the assets, about 96 billion rand per year. So in the next 2 years, we will then add that. But the return that Eskom has been given on those re-evaluated assets is not the 10.03, or the 8.16 that we have calculated, but it's 0.08 in the first year, 2.8 in the following year, and 4.2 in the other year. The next slide, slide number 17, really looks at, breaks down what I've just indicated. It looks at the return on the assets. It looks at what Eskom would have got or gets by virtue of the depreciation of the reevaluated assets, and it looks at the, when you add those two, that's the actual return that Eskom gets. Then you then have the line that says the left IDC, that shows now the interest during construction. The bottom line shows Eskom's net position. In Eskom's application, you would see that they would indicate that in the first year they will have a shortfall of this much, and the following year they will have a shortfall of about 8 billion rand in 2010-11 and 14 billion rand in 11-12 if they were given the 35% increase. This one shows that with the 25% increase, that shortfall will be reduced by those amounts that we have shown there. So they can, because we have enabled this net position by adjusting the interest during construction, it also pushes the other view that we have that Eskom in 2009-10, when they had a capital expenditure of around 92 billion rand, they were able to borrow 47 billion rand. And the conditions prevailing then were not very exciting. So if they could borrow 47 billion rand under those market conditions, we are allowing them enough revenue. And 1.1 billion rand coming out of this Eskom net position would enable them to borrow an additional 10 billion rand so as to reduce the requirement to want to fund or to assist their capital expenditure by funding it through the processes that they are using. So that net position is an indication that the pressure that the pricing, the allowed revenue has placed on Eskom can be relieved if Eskom can borrow more, and there is the additional amount that Eskom would need to borrow that. And if they could borrow 47 billion rand in this year, there's no reason why they should limit their borrowing to 40 billion rand this year. They should bring their borrowing closer to the 47 billion rand. Now, the next slide really shows what you what we use as the work under construction, excuse me, not work under construction, the weighted average cost of capital. Now, when projects, and we have had this during our presentations, when you ring fence a project, if you have to take Medupi as a power station and say you are going to ring fence and take it out of Eskom, normally projects like that are funded by saying that 80% of the amount that is required for Medupi would be funded through debt. You would borrow the money, the other 20% would come from equity. Now, and with that sort of calculation, you then get to what is called the weighted average cost of capital. independent power producers, when they are going to invest in your country, they would always want a figure of about 3% higher than the 3% that even the Reserve Bank government has spoken about, additional to what is called the weighted average or weighted average cost of capital. So the return that an independent power producer would require to build those stations would not be the 8.16. It would be 8.16 plus 3% for them to be interested. And Eskom had used the 10.03, but we then allowed 3%. We allowed 8.16%. But if you were to use independent power producers, that rate of return or the weighted average cost of capital, you have to add another 3% to that. Slide number 19 really looks at the ESCOM's energy efficiency and demand side management requirements. The total amount that ESCOM required was about 6.2 billion rand, and the amount that we have allowed them is around 5.4 billion rand. The 6.2 billion rand included the solar water heaters, about 260,000 of the solar water heaters for the first year, for all of the years, 70% of which would have been funded by the rebate process, where you don't, ESCOM wouldn't pay for the full amount of the geyser. The other 30% would have been paying for the full amount of the geyser. The projects that we disallowed in ESCOM's demand side management, as I indicated, that energy efficiency and demand side management, the plan that we currently have assumes that consumers of South Africa will be able to reduce their consumption by 8.5 terawatt hours over the 3 years. And if that doesn't happen, we will then have a situation where we are coming closer to meeting, where our demand comes closer to meeting our supply, which is the event that we have to try and avoid. But so the demand side management by far has been allowed, the funds for the demand side management have been allowed to ESCOM, so as to ensure that we implement these measures that would save us from load shedding. But processes or measures that we've taken out of this was, one of the measures was here in the Western Cape, where ESCOM gave out gas stoves and the gas stoves, people were also given cylinders to cook with. But when the cylinder, the gas was not available and most people return back to using electricity. So programs like that are not sustainable, and we have disallowed them from them being funded via the tariff. But the other projects of changing compact fluorescent lights, they changed 36 million compact fluorescent lights. We have allowed for an additional 8 million rand, and then there's a formula you can calculate that those lights last for 6,000 hours, and if people use them responsibly, they should be changed all the time, and you can get the reduction of 10% in your consumption. So that was what is really defined in slide number 20. And 21 really looks at the figures, the total of the figures that we have now saved. So the first one is the primary energy. In the first year, we've reduced by 1.2 billion rand, operating cost by 1.4 billion rand. But if you look at the total efficiencies from ESCOM's application, when they applied, in the first year we've removed 7 billion rand, in the second year we removed 17 billion rand, in the fourth year we removed 34 billion rand. Now the slide, I just want to jump to slide number 23. I will come back to slide number 22. When we were going through that process, as the chairperson indicated, we did start at no increase, and no increase meant that we would have maybe no ESCOM and no power. We then started increasing, and we got to about 15% increase, and the 15% increase meant that in 4 years' time, in 5 years' time, ESCOM would have a debt-equity ratio of about 94%. When a company has a debt-equity ratio of 94%, it is a company that's close to being bankrupt. So if we had given ESCOM a 15% increase over the 3 years, on year four, they would have been close to being bankrupt if you assume that they still have to fund the capital expenditure that they have. So 15% meant bankruptcy, and it also meant that you will have to give 15% increases for the next 11 years if you want to keep ESCOM afloat. So that scenario was also not a scenario that that the Electricity Regulation Act allows us to entertain. The next one was 1718, but I'm just taking that if you go to 20%, you would see that your increases would have provided the debt equity ratio that goes close to 80% on year five. But most importantly, you would see that what is known as the shortfall would start increasing by year 2014-15. The shortfall would be close to about 64 billion rand. That also is not encouraging, and it would also not enable ESCOM to borrow money, because the funders would also want to see that your debt equity ratio, which is defined in the last line, that comes closer to the figure of 2. If it goes below 2, they would want to see a recovery path that is very convincing, and which is why Moody's has also indicated that they would now grade ESCOM accordingly, because the plan that is here shows that on year 3, at the end of this, their debt equity ratio or debt service cover ratio would be looking at sitting at around 2. You can obviously see that when you look at the 35% scenario, their debt equity ratio and the debt service cover ratio would go above the figure that are required. It would have been a fairly comfortable ride for us from what we have provided them with the 25% increase. Still provides the shortfall, but the shortfalls fall off on year 5. By 2014-15, there would be no shortfall. ESCOM would be operating. By that time, they would have recovered to the level of even 2.5 in debt service cover ratio, which is the debt service cover ratio that is required by the rating that they have. So the 25% was looking at all of the different scenarios. Our function is also to ensure that the electricity supply industry is efficient, effective, sustainable, both in the long and the short term. And that balancing that we have to do of choosing getting to a percentage increase that would ensure that consumers are not completely stifled, but at the other hand, the utility manages to breathe. But then, if I may go back to slide number 22, to deal with the other part that the electricity pricing policy requires. The electricity pricing policy requires that we must have an inclining block tariff, which says that the more you use, the more you pay. The less you use, the less you pay. We have then segmented the tariffs in an inclining way for the residential customers, where we take the first block. First 50 kilowatts is the first block. Block 2 is 51 to 350. Block 3 is 351 to 600. And block 4 is 600 and above. Now, the first block, the first 50 kilowatts, normally for those that are considered poor or indigent, they get the first 50 kilowatts free. But most people don't qualify for that. Most municipalities don't even do this implementation of the free basic electricity. But what you would notice is that with the inclining block tariffs, the current tariffs, and this is for ESCOM, but the figures that I'm using here for the municipalities are pretty similar, because there's a table that shows that the municipalities, what you have is ESCOM is more the midpoint, but we have a range for the municipalities, because all of them, you can't use a one-size-fits-all to all of them, because they have different peculiarities, but we have a range or a bandwidth, and we apply pretty much the same principle. So for those who are using electricity less or even if you use more, but for your first 50 kilowatt hours, you would then pay 10% less with this increase that has been implemented. For your second 51 to 350, you would pay 5% less. For 351 to 600 kilowatt, you will pay 21%. Above 600, you would pay, there would be an increase of 35%. That's for this year. And the reason why it has been done like that is for two reasons. One, ESCOM and some of the municipalities have not prepared their systems to be able to deal with all of the peculiarities of having inclining block tariffs. But our view is that inclining block tariffs are a requirement of the electricity pricing policy, just like the reevaluation of the assets is a requirement of the electricity pricing policy. We have implemented the electricity pricing policy on re-evaluation of assets, and we also are required by the electricity pricing policy to implement it. And the process of getting this corrected, it is not a process that would take forever. It is a process that can be corrected within a period of 6 months. We accept that within municipalities there are no changes that can be implemented during the course of the year. Hence, it would be that block of having the inclining block tariffs with the structures that have been indicated would be implemented mainly in the first year. In the second year of the multi-year price determination, for the first block, the increase would be 5.4%. For the second block, the increase will be 13%, and for the third block, it will be 25.8%, and the fourth block. And in the third year of the multi-year price determination, the increase will still be 5.5%, and 13.5% and 25.9% for the other blocks, which is part of the implementation of the pricing policy, which provides the insulation that is required for the poor, or the poorest of the poor. The last slide really shows some of the slide number 24 and 25, which really shows some of the indicators and the pointers that we looked at. For instance, with the 20, if I look at inflation, with the 25% increase, the contribution by electricity we have modeled it to come to about 0.44%, and 35 it would have been 60, and the others really show that. That there would be a reduction in employment, but by 1.5%, and the imports would be reduced by 1.26% if it was a 20% increase, and 1.58%. But I also have to say that that's the short-term impact. The long-term impact looks very different. If you look at the inflation with the 25% increase, the long-term impact shows that the inflation would be affected by 4%, but long-term, in our case, looks at 10 years from now. And Chairperson?
In conclusion, Chairperson and members of... Yes, I am. Yes, the ESCOM pricing list was determined to ensure enough revenue for ESCOM to continue their business, but taking into cognizance the economic impact of the price increase on the economy. And secondly, the recommendations from the rating agencies were taken into account to ensure critical ratios, that is your debt equity ratio, your debt coverage ratio, and manage those satisfactorily. We also, in the inclining block tariff, were able to implement, as per government policy, the cushioning the cushioning of the poorest of the poor via granting them a decrease in 2010-11, and then overall a 5% increase on the use of electricity. Therefore, Chairperson, it is our submission that 25% average increase across the board is the slowest phasing in required increases that maintain minimum economic health of ESCOM over the short and the medium term. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the comprehensive and very elaborate input. But I think we needed that, I'm sure, as members of Parliament, to acquaint ourselves with all the issues raised. May I then open for, if you say questions for clarity, they end up being part of the deliberations. Can you just take, if there are any questions for clarity, we'll take them, but also if members would like to input or ask questions generally, let's do that, because time is not on our side exactly. At 12:30, there's a memorial service for the late Deputy Minister of Health. So we should be attending that, I'm sure, most of us here. But we still have to deal with our own report on the third and budget. Can I then give to members Ross, Mutau, Lucas, Dexter, and Quinn, in that order?
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, on the 12th of
for last month. We had the privilege to visit Nurse, and I think many of our queries as the DA were addressed, and we were very well received, and we thanked the regulator for the opportunity that we had to visit your offices. However, we are still concerned about the situation as we see it, that we find cross-subsidized situation where a very selectively narrow band of residential consumers seems to be subsidizing the poor, which of course is a good thing. The poor needs to be helped, but also subsidizing the bigger business. If we take, for an example, 138 companies paying an average of 17 cents per kilowatt hour, while household consumers paying 80 cents per kilowatt hour. And in practice, the 38% for residential consumers using more than 600 kilowatt hours per month is quite a hectic task for any ordinary South African citizen. And we are quite concerned that we know that Eskom has to meet its obligations, but normal people also have their obligations. In terms of the middle class of South African citizens that need to foot the bill. And in our deliberations also at our strategic planning session, the minister also acknowledged that this is the middle class that we have to apply our minds. In our first submission to NERSA, we agreed that tariffs could be revised, but we have to apply our minds how people will meet this huge challenge. Taking in consideration, Chairperson, that the special price agreement seems to be controversial. NERSA had full privilege to the Eskom contract with Billiton, and nowhere in the Eskom application to NERSA any reference was made to the effects of the two Billiton contracts and what they would have on the price adjudication by NERSA on the Eskom application. Now, we assume perhaps that this effect was that the special price agreements were taken in consideration. But there's also a new situation that we've read in the newspaper the last 2 days, that there's a renegotiation process taking place between Eskom and Billiton, and we would like to know what the effect would be, perhaps on pricing for ordinary South Africans. Thank you. That concludes my first question, Chairperson.
When you were saying we under the first application or the submission, whom did you mean? We who?
The DA had an appointment with NERSA.
Please.
To clarify.
We are, okay,
thank you.
Thanks for the clarity, but I think here we are here as members of the portfolio committee, all of us. So don't try to confuse us with your separate private meetings that you met with the NERSA. It was within your own right to do so. So can we then be able then to discuss in terms of the presentation that was presented today? For your own report back, I think you must also do your private meetings. I think that will help us rather than quoting the we and the if you, and I'm sure explicit to say as the DA we made whatever. Can we do that maybe? Just for smooth the process of the meeting. Mota?
Thank you, Chair. Sorry for being late. We got stuck in traffic. Just as one of my bird box, we are in a catch-22 situation. Clearly, Eskom needs money to do these things that have to do. My concern is this. There are two concerns, two big concerns. NERSA seems to be satisfied that with this framework in place, things are going to be okay. In 3 years' time, we will be okay. We will be looking at the kinds of things that we're looking at the year 2012, 2013, and it will be okay. How is this going to be done? Eskom is prone to come to the government and say, we need money, we need a bailout. How is this going to be done? What is NERSA going to be able to do to make sure, for instance, that the efficiencies that are expected to be derived from this plan are going to actually materialize? Who's going to monitor this? Is NERSA going to make sure that these things happen? Because if they don't happen, then the plan collapses. The other question, and that is a very important one, because if you look at the plan, the inclining block tariffs, and that is good. My concern is still, you know, a 5% increase to somebody who's indigent is still a lot of money. You know, 5% when you have nothing is a lot. But be that as it may, many of the municipalities we have are under administration. We've just heard that many of them don't even cannot even apply the system. How are the people going to draw this benefit, if it is a benefit? What can NERSA do? Because NERSA is supposed to actually look at these things. What can the regulator do to make sure that these things actually do happen? Because if they don't happen, then, of course, you know, the conundrum in which we find ourselves with service delivery just gets worse and worse. Thanks, Chair.
Yes, thanks. I think this is one instance where the South African public was toasted together because it didn't expect any increase because of the situation. We've all been hit by what happened internationally. And ESCOM, I think one of our mistakes has been that we did not discover why it ended up in this position. If we got to down to say, this is the cause of it, maybe we could repair it. But what we decided on is to pump extra capital into this year. Are we sure that this exercise is going to get them out of that rut? I am very concerned. Because there's nothing else that seems to be done. It's just additional funds pumped into an organization which landed itself in such a horrible situation. Secondly, I don't know whether the money spent on hearings was necessary, because I honestly believe is that this decision was just, there was emotional. We could have even saved that money that we went out hearing and put it back into ESCOM, because the 35% which they were claiming, I think this was a red herring. They didn't want 35%. They were saying, well, right, we'll bargain at this type and we'll meet halfway. And that's my fear. Those are my serious fears. And there's a lot of money that's outstanding that municipalities, townships owe ESCOM. Have they recovered those money? And how much is owing? The other thing is that it is sad when big business are getting electricity at a reduced rate. It's pathetic. I've asked this question many a time, even the electricity that we've been sending outside the country. And the reply I got was, well, these are arrangements which have been signed many years ago. Therefore, they cannot be altered. So people are riding on the backs of the poor. And it's interesting to see how many times you are talking about the poor. But I'm not too sure whether we have really taken the interest of the poor. I will say this again. The majority of us in this country does not have electricity. High power lines were going right through past our homes, going to a little farm out far away, and we were not allowed electricity. And suddenly there was something happening, because if you fly over at night in the rural area, you see electricity, and this has been highly appreciated. It's been highly appreciated. However, the first people who are going to suffer from this are going to be those same people who have just got electricity. That is the unfortunate part, because they are the first ones to suffer. There's unemployment, and they will have to... Where are they going to get the money from? It really pains my heart, this whole issue. So the explanation here, I think, I'm lost. How did those poor people who came to the meeting understand what is this situation and how is it going to work and how ESCOM's recovery? Because if business was worked the way we dream for ESCOM, we all could be in business. Because you just say, well, I'll get the money from you guys. You pay the money and I get the business. And I'll assure you that I'm not going to run it a lot. And business would be one of the best things to do. We had this problem with moss gas. Moss gas came regularly to us to ask for money every year because they knew they were going to get it. And the only change has happened now with Petro SA that there are some things that are happening. And when what puzzles me also is that at the beginning, Eskom was doing extremely well. It had a serious purpose. All of a sudden, we find ourselves we are just out of situation as far as concern, finances are concerned. We don't know where the money is, and there's huge bonuses are being paid, and all these things that are happening. So I'm concerned that we have not got to the bottom of the issue, and which we should do, get to the bottom, and this do that and repair the damages at that level. If there's a smell in this room, if we pray doom and we pray all the nice things and don't find that rat, we will suffer again.
Thanks, Chair. Chair, I think that we should say that we understand that the situation we find ourselves in is not of nurses making. So any comments that we make, I really don't want them to take it as an attack on NERSA because, you know, this is a very serious issue. So I want to preface what I want to say by that we fully understand how we got to where we are and the crisis that we're in. But having said that, there are a couple of things that worry me. The one is, I'd like to get clarity on the economic modeling that you've been talking about, on the impacts and so on. Who did that for you? Did you do it in-house or did you get independent people? Because it seems to me to be an optimistic one, if to say the very least. I'm not convinced by the predictions in terms of the economic impacts of the pricing. The second thing is that we've just gone through a very controversial period, and it's not over yet by a long shot, around this issue of the World Bank loan to Eskom and so on. Now, I know that doesn't fall directly under the purview of NERSA, but I think NERSA is an interested party. Of course, you are the regulator, and obviously whatever other additional funding Eskom gets has an impact on what you are doing and the modeling and so on. So I'd like to give us your view on whether or not that loan and the terms and conditions of it, et cetera, are of significance and what that will mean for what you presented to us. And within that, also, I do think that one of the issues that bedevils this issue of the loan is this Chancellor House story. And surely the regulator has a view on whether this kind of situation is an acceptable one, since part of what you're doing is supposedly looking after the interests of the consumers and the public. The fourth issue is that I think where NERSA really could do more is putting pressure on Eskom to change the way it's doing things. I mean, it's one thing to accept that you've got to get 25% increases and so on. I acknowledge that, as Mr. Lucas says, we're pretty much between a rock and a hard place here. You know, if they need the revenue, they need the revenue. But there seems to be no compulsion on Eskom to change the way it's doing things. For instance, putting more emphasis on renewable energy rather than, you know, the route that it's gone. Really opening up and liberalizing to allow independent producers. I mean, if conditionalities were put in the same way that they would be put on by funders, by NERSA, that would put a lot of impetus into the system for change. So what I'm suggesting is that NERSA needs to be a little more radical, because part of the public perception about NERSA is that it's a rubber stamp anyway. I mean, if you look at the public process that you've gone through, it doesn't matter what people have said in the hearing process. We all know the outcome anyway. So it's kind of a cynical exercise, really, you know, that we go through. We pretend to the poor that they can influence what's going to happen. We pretend to business and so on, and come and participate in a process. But we all know the outcome. So, you know, given that, I think that NERSA could be doing a lot more to position itself differently, because we all want NERSA to succeed. You know, we understand the significance of NERSA. But at the moment, you're a bit of a toothless wonder, if you'll pardon the expression. Then the last thing is that, I get the sense that we've had this discussion in the committee already, that the main problem we face is not the issue of Eskom's tariff increases and so on. It's a complete lack of an adequate strategy in the energy sector. That's the real problem. And to the extent that NERSA can influence that process, I really think we need to hear from you. Because if you limit your scope to just what would be the economic impact of 25%, blah, 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 well, that's all well and good. But it's not going to get us out of the hole that Mr. Lucas is referring to. Thanks, Jim.
Thank you, Chair. Sorry about that. I concur with my colleague's comments around the issue of public participation. I mean, I think NERSA was probably also between a rock and a hard place. I mean, I sat in on some of the hearings and listened to many of the presentations, many of which I thought were excellent and which really put forward a different kind of paradigm for South Africa's energy future. What I was interested in, though, was what was the kind of scope that NERSA had to actually engage with those particular presentations? Because as far as I see it, you probably were limited in terms of the IRP and in terms of the proposal put forward by Eskom. Because what I've seen in your outcome is essentially you've engaged with those documents rather than actually engaged with the paradigm that's underpinning those documents. And why I say that is that clearly, you have looked forward to a kind of coal-based future, which is what Eskom has put forward and which the IRP initially put forward too. You didn't, like for instance, did you have the scope to say that we can approve a certain tariff increase, but the remaining amount of the money should be raised through a tax, which is what Kusatu was proposing? Did you have the scope of NERSA to be able to make such a statement, or were you constrained by what was before you? I mean, I'd just be interested to hear how much leeway you had to really engage with this, because it will also give us some insight into how these public participation processes should be run in the future. I mean, I heard one presenter say that she has come here time and time again and has been basically disregarded in terms of the presentations that's been put forward. And clearly we don't want to waste people's time. If you aren't able to engage with those and take those things on board, then it needs to be made clear to the public what your scope is and what can be entertained and what can't be. I think that's something that needs to be looked at. The other issue that I was looking at here, people have mentioned the cost of big business. Now, there's two issues around energy-intensive users in South Africa. The one is the Megaflex, which includes 138 companies. Now, there's big debate around that as to whether it's cheaper to supply them, and therefore that's why they get a cheaper rate according to the Megaflex, and that's a debate that can happen and which I think NERSA is involved in. The big issue, though, is the 10 other contracts which Eskom has signed pre-94 and with very energy-intensive companies, which I think account for about 10% of South Africa's energy. Now, we have read in the news that they are busy trying to renegotiate those contracts. But, I mean, is this something that should fall outside of the ambit of NERSA? Surely the time has now come that if we are in the process of renegotiating these contracts, for all of those contracts to, in fact, come in and fall under the ambit of NERSA. Why should we have a situation where 10% of South Africa's energy is negotiated according to a secret contract with Eskom and our energy regulator has absolutely no say in that? I mean, surely that is an untenable situation, because if we simply take that 10% out, our reserve margin goes up to an acceptable level. And the point is that NERSA needs to have control of that. I mean, do you agree with that sentiment, and do you not think that we should be looking at bringing those contracts in under the ambit of these particular price increases? I'll just be interested to hear your comments on that. The other thing is that when you look at the demand side management, you said that you provided funding for only 260,000 solar water heaters, but we set a target as government of 1 million solar water heaters. Where is the other funding coming from? I mean, is this coming from the Department of Energy? Is it coming from other sources, or is this something that isn't of concern to NERSA as such? I mean, what is of concern to us is that this is probably the least cost option of increasing our reserve margin, of saving South Africa electricity and doing it at the least cost. So surely we should be pumping more money into solar water heaters rather than into some of the other things that we are pumping money into in terms of this proposal. So I'd just be interested to hear what you say there. And then just lastly, in terms of the capital expenditure that you mentioned, and you mentioned that Eskom's going to run into trouble at a later date in terms of its debt equity ratio because of its capital expenditure. Does this capital expenditure include Casida? Because I know that was in the IRP. And I think there's a big question mark over Casida. And so if you include that capital expenditure, saying that Eskom now has to start building Casida as well, then clearly we're going to run into trouble. But if we take out Casida and say that actually we're open to other possibilities, that we don't need to build a second coal-fired power station after Medupi, then we have a different scenario. So I'm just interested to see what goes into the capital expenditure. Is it just Medupi or is it Casida as well? And then just lastly, the point of Chancellor House. Now, I know that's not directly under your ambit, but what is under your ambit is the cost of Medupi. I mean, clearly what has happened here is that Eskom's come to you to say this is the amount of capital expenditure that we need to build Medupi Power Station. But surely do you not have a role to go and look into those contracts and find out that we are actually getting value for money in terms of the building of Medupi and making sure that we actually aren't being fleeced by other people in terms of the cost that the country has to pay for that? I mean, I have other questions, but I'll leave it for the next round. Thank you.
Just as the follow up in terms of the cost and the agreement signed with the companies, I just want to get a sense as to, I'm sure you do have or you are privy to the when are those licenses expiring? Is it nearby or is it still 5-10 years to come? Whatever, if you have the information, and linked to that, immediately after you announced as NERSA, the first reaction was that plus minus 250,000 jobs to be lost due to the increase, which to me it was a surprise because if industry is paying less in any way, why then the 250,000 then a job losses as compared to the poor who are going to pay more? So was that a thumbs up figure or maybe you also agree with those commentators who are saying that 250 jobs are on the line due to the increase? Or it was just a speculation, or other people just taking a ride on this, or what? Linked to the question of the industry paying less in any way within the agreement that they signed with Eskom. So you know that maybe if you have clarity, if you don't, I would take it. So I think that was the first round. Can we then get the response from yourself?
The first questions that we asked were around the 138 customers that are on a different tariff. I have to mention that the 138 customers that are called the key customers of Eskom are on different tariffs, Mega Flex, Rural Flex, and there's a whole host of those tariffs. There's about 14 of them that are approved. And the prices that they pay are open. If you go to Eskom's website now, you'll find that. What is not in the public domain is who has signed which contract. That is the part that is confidential. You will not know if Highveld Steel has signed the same contract as Afmang. That is not in the public domain. But the actual tariffs that they select from are in the public domain. And the prices that they pay, if you look at the average, in what has been approved, which is also in the public domain, which has been approved, the price is around 41.57 cents. It is not 17 cents. Now the difference between I think Honorable Hailing has spoken about the difference between supplying a customer that is at distribution level and supplying one that is at transmission level. The fact and the truth of the matter is that the industrial customers are supplied at voltages that are high. So it means that from the generator, you need one line and at a higher voltage, and it goes to the customer. it is different from the cost that is required by the domestic customers, where it is that line, another transformer, another cable, and bringing down the voltages that are generated, 765,000 volts, bringing them down to 220 volts. There are costs involved. So when it comes to the actual cost and the cost reflectivity of the issue, it is a fact that supplying a customer that is taking voltages at high levels would be cheaper than supplying one that's taking it at 220 volts. The other part that we can talk about is the subsidies around that, and I think that that is a different matter. But in as far as the actual cost, it is a fact, and it cannot be disputed. I think I've addressed. You also mentioned that in the documentation that NERSA has given, there is no mention of a special pricing agreement. In the slide that I started with, if you look at the bottom slide, the bottom part of the slide, where we have the allowed revenue for the other sales is 85 billion rand, and then the total expected revenue from all customers, and I did mention that the total expected revenue of 90 billion rand includes the special pricing agreement, includes the other utilities, international customers. And in the full document, that is the reason for the decision. It even tells you what the amount is. The 90.927 includes that. It says for all customers. That includes the special pricing agreements. That includes the international customers. Then the question from Honorable Mtawe was how are these energy efficiencies that we are talking about going to be extracted? The Electricity Regulation Act, the Section 4 of the Electricity Regulation Act, requires us to ensure that we enforce compliance, we monitor compliance, and we set the standards of compliance. And as a creature of statute, we have operated within what we are allowed by the legislation. And these are the targets that we have set, and these efficiency extractions, ESCOM reports to the energy regulator on a quarterly basis. And when they start to deviate from the amounts that they've been given, they have to explain. And if it's deviations that are within a certain threshold, that will have to be taken off their bottom line. If it's deviations that are above a certain threshold and there are reasons for those deviations, for an example, let's take operating of the open cycle gas turbines. They may well operate those open cycle gas turbines for the 6%, but if the price of diesel goes up, they have no control over that. That is an amount that we'd have to look at. But if it doesn't go up by a margin that is too much, then they also have to swallow that. That is the risk of running that entity. But we monitor that, and we ensure that they operate within the margins that we have given them in the rules that Mr. Mgwena indicated to of the multi-year price determination rules. So that extraction is what we do, and those reports are available to the public every time that ESCOM provides them, and we do the analysis and indicate what they should be doing to rectify where they are going astray and to encourage more efficiencies where they are deriving additional efficiencies. And NERSA, in the second question about the implementation the free basic electricity, implementation of the tariffs that we have approved in the different municipalities, there's 184 municipalities that are licensed, and a good 70 to 80% of them do perform according to what is required. Not in the numbers, but there are those that we have endless fights with, and I think one of them that we used to have endless fights with was Sunduzi, and I think we've also had endless fights with the city of Cape Town around the implementation of the tariffs that we have approved. There, we accept that we still need to improve, but I think the improvement is not so much of NERSA, but the improvement is for the whole country and the municipalities, because we can impose as much as we want to impose. If on the ground the municipalities don't have what is required to maintain and to do this to the system, we're probably also are imposing things that are not implementable, but it is a total solution that is required. But I accept that we have to improve around ensuring that the electricity supply industry, specifically the distribution industry, is operated in a manner that is efficient and in a manner that is effective.
Thank you.
Honorable Ravalukas, the part about why we ended up in this position, I think that it has been said in different ways, but the fact and the truth of the matter is we're in a position where we do not have enough electricity generation to meet our demand. And the exercise that we have gone through, in the past we would give Eskom revenues and say you are allowed to do this, but these revenues, the difference between these revenues and what has been done in the past is that these are now being ring-fenced. Eskom does not have the luxury of taking money from another area of the business that we have ring-fenced and just putting it there. They can't take money from the amount that has been set aside for IPP and coal generators and refit and just go and use it in the generation of that. That is the way that we have structured this. And implementing it, yes, I accept that we will have the challenges that any other system when it's implemented for the first time would have. But we also have the experiences from what we have done, the studies we've done, of the other entities that are regulated that are similar to Eskom of what you need to do. We have provided them with what we call regulatory reporting manuals, which enable us to see beyond what Eskom even gives us to ensure that we always steer them in the direction that we require them to go to. Maybe my chairperson will indicate whether the hearings were necessary, but I think just on my take, the hearings, as Mr. Mgwena said, were necessary because we get to hear the things that we need to hear. But when we are required to increase tax, the legislation that establishes us says nothing about us and tax. So there is nothing we can do there. That we have to accept, much as we would want to increase it. The other legislation that talks about environmental levy, that must be charged. As much as we would like to reduce it, or as much as we would like to say that National Treasury must take it and use it to promote renewable energies, even when we suggest that, because when we get, when we come back from the public hearings, we visit all of the ministers and say, these are the facts that we have gathered for you, Minister of Finance, we have gathered these facts. They say tax this, they say the environmental levy must be used for this. And in simple terms, we've been told in many of the departments, but I'll mention National Treasury, that, listen, the environmental levy is our domain. We collect it and we'll use it in a way that we see fit. You go and regulate what you have the mandate to regulate. So we've been told that very clearly. So most of the suggestions that people have made, like increase free basic electricity, even if we wanted to, we don't have the mandate to increase free basic electricity. Even if we wanted to impose the tax, we don't have the mandate to impose the tax. Even if we wanted to say that Eskom must go and get money, more money from the government, we don't have the mandate to tell them that. The shareholder minister is the one that can do that. The part that we can do is enable them to borrow more money by the tariffs that we give them and by ring-fencing those monies. And that we have done. And we have done it to the best of our abilities. But we have done it. There's no other way of doing it in ensuring that this is other than the way that we have done it, in my view. And the money is being owed to Eskom. I mentioned the bad area debt that Eskom had planned to increase it. For, I think it's 0.5% to 0.8%, and that we have reduced and said that you will have to find better ways of doing that. But with municipalities, I also have to say that by a few, most of the municipalities do pay Eskom. By a few international customers or companies that have gone under. Eskom's bad debt is improving, but it still needs to even improve better. I think the implementation of prepaid meters and all of that has reduced this area of monies that are not being paid. And as a country, in your last question that we are selling electricity, as a country, we're a net importer. So we buy more electricity than we sell. And the one that we buy it cheaper. Yes, the contracts that are there between BPC and the others, they do get approved by NERSA, and they are charged using the same principle of saying that you must ensure that an efficient licensee recovers the full cost, and when you set tariffs, they must then reflect that. And the others that were entered into other contracts, yes, I think they are coming to an end, and Madam Chair, one of the contracts that are being negotiated now, I think one had 8 years to go, but they already have agreed to negotiate it, and they are close to really agreeing and signing, and it will also then come into the space of being regulated by NERSA, especially the certain parts of it, and it will be decoupled from the aluminium prices or the commodity prices. But that process is underway, and I think there was an announcement last week, but it still has to come to the regulator for approval of the parts that require the approval of the regulator, for instance, the wheeling. So that process is underway and it's yielding the necessary results. So, to sum it up, we get electricity cheaper. I mean, we pay very little money for the hydro water from Kaora Basa and Lesotho. But yes, we also have contracts that have kind of locked us in, but that are also increased by inflation and other amounts, and they are coming to an end that would come into the same process of ensuring that we have contracts that are aligned to what it costs to produce electricity. And, Honorable Dexter, I appreciate the fact that at least you know that in some of the things that we have to do, we are going in there to the ring with our hands tied, and all we can do is get punched, which is not similar. It's not different from what we are getting here. But, yeah. The economic modeling that we did it, we have economists that are solely there to do this, but we also have the pleasure and the wealth of being a few blocks away from the Reserve Bank, and we normally have boxing matches with them around issues. And if you would notice that in the first meeting, electricity was mentioned as an issue, but in the second meeting, there was not even a mention of electricity. We have come to agree on some things. But we also use the Bureau of Economic Research to bounce. And as you know, that in economic issues and in modeling, it's really an opinion. It is not a true science. It is an opinion. And our opinion is aligned with many other opinions. And the World Bank, the terms and the conditions, one of the terms and the conditions of the World Bank, which is different from the other loans that Eskom, is that Eskom must build renewable energy. So in the term, in the condition, they have to build 150 megawatts of renewables. It would be small relative to the amount that we have, but let's then go to the other point that sometimes we don't accept. A kilowatt of electricity costs 33 cents and it will cost 41 cents when it's produced from coal. And one that is produced from solar PV costs 4 rand, so it's 10 times the amount. So we cannot afford to just bring solar because it will not be affordable. We have to blend it with the one that we have over time. And to show that that process is underway, 12 billion rand of the money that has been allowed to Eskom now has already been ring-fenced to say that we'll bring coal generation, some independent power producers, and the renewable energies. But you cannot just get power from solar because it will be 4 rand. Then it will be 1,000 or 10,000% increase, which will definitely be unaffordable if we are only going to get it from solar. The second part about solar is the sun only shines during the day. So you can get the solar. But if you want to store it, it costs even more using batteries or solar. So we have to accept that we have to do this blending. Over time, we will get to that level where we can use all of the resources that we have as a country, solar, wind, uranium, and coal, in a way that gives us the benefit as a country. But as we speak, if you put in PV, 4 rand, if you put in wind, you are not going to change the when you have wind, it's like when you have your car freewheeling down, you can't switch it off because wind blows when it wants to and it stops when it wants to. So you have to have those coal-fired stations blowing. So as a total, the regulator, and even Eskom for that matter, is not opposed to renewable energies. But I think the way we are going to introduce them has to deal with the issues of the affordability that we're talking about. And monies have been set aside to ensure that we blend the 40,000 megawatts of coal with the at 33 cents with the 4 rand, but not have the price shocks. And over time, we will have this crossover point, but it is not now. It's 10 years from now. So. The one about the Chancellor House and our view on that, I think maybe our chairperson is more qualified to answer. I'm not. I don't even think that we have a view. and the pressure on Eskom to emphasize renewable energies, 12 billion rand over the 3 years, Eskom has to ring fence. it has to be used for the renewable energies. Whether it's enough or not is also another part that we influence, but we are not the ones who dictate. The Integrated Resources Plan is a plan that is developed by the Department of Energy. It gets given to us to say implement. That we do, and we do it to the best of our ability. And when it does not have the renewables and the other things, we are unfortunately cannot do things that we cannot act out of virus. We have to act within the confines of the legislation that establishes us. And in the ones that they give us, we implement. We are in the process now of concluding the selection criteria. Contrary to the popular belief that our public hearings don't add much, those who come to the public hearings for the renewable energies will tell you that when they give us information, we take the information, synthesize, and correct. And a typical example was when we sent out the first renewable energy feed-in tariff, we had figures of around 80 cents for wind. We got inputs from the wind developers in the public hearings, which we wouldn't have got if we didn't have the public hearings, and they corrected us to move to around 125, and those are, for us, are the inputs that are available or valuable and useful in the public hearing. So we require the public hearings. They may not be seen as useful by others, but certainly as a regulator, we see them as points where we get the necessary and useful information. And then on the public process, I mean, the toothless wonder, I think it is also, I don't know what it means to do that, but we do the things that we can do within the confines that we have, and rather than complaining about what we can't do, we just do the ones that we can do, and we do those well. The public participation and Honorable Kheling and the scope of engagement, I may have indicated that people do provide us with inputs. I mean, there are people who come and give us inputs around what rating agencies would look at, and they will tell us what they do for companies. They just forget one element, which is important, that rating agencies, when they look at Shell alone, but rating agencies, when they look at Eskom, they look at Eskom, and then they look at the government, and that makes a big difference. So these inputs are there. Some of them are good, but I think the context is sometimes what is lacking. And there are other cases where we learn and we understand that these are the issues that we must look at. For instance, we didn't know that when we were doing the refit, we didn't know that if we just give investors a weighted average cost of capital as a return, they would not come. And which is why we had the 80 cents per kilowatt hour point. So when we knew that, we set the return on investment at the level that is required, and it provided the input that made the investors flock in. So we do learn from the. For us, the scope of engagement is very fruitful. I think that maybe for the consumers, it may not be, because we do not make the decisions that they say we must make, but we can only make the ones we can make within the confines of the legislation that establishes that. And yes, there's a need for a paradigm shift, and for us, I've indicated that the Integrated Resources Plan is a plan of this country. If you want to deviate from that, the law says that you must apply for the deviation to the minister. And so it is not as though it's nice and closed and you can't do it. If there's a requirement to deviate, you must apply to the minister. And on a number of occasions, we have, when we approved the Bethlehem hydro scheme, which was not on the IRP, when we approved the 10 Williams of Clarkson Power, which was not on the IRP, and when we approved SAPI co-generation, so we have deviated to enable independent power producers to come into the space. And I think I've indicated the one about tax, that as much as we can say, we've been told in not so nice ways about where we should go when we talk about tax. And the cost of big business and the mega flats, there's about 14 different tariffs. They don't necessarily take mega flats. I mean, others take rural flats. Others, I've just forgotten the names. But there's different tariffs. Mega flats, and there's also WEP, which is wholesale electricity price structure. So mega flats is by far the one that is better for those who are taking it in bulk and taking it at a certain level. But there are other industries that are even taking it at a lower level, and there's a tariff suitable for that. And the contracts signed before 1994, as I've indicated, most of them are being reviewed. The one that was going to last longest is an 8-year term. The one of the others is The one that is less than 10 years old is also being reviewed, and most of those will come into the scope of being regulated by NASA. Now, on the targets about DSM costs 6 billion rand. If we were to put in the other million solar water heaters and assume that they are funded from the tariff, then the tariff increase would be 40%. Because it's 6 billion rand per year, 6, 18, 24. That's what we would have to put in for the million. But so the tariff increase would be that, and it would have not been affordable either. But there are other methods that are being used. Some of the funds are going to come from the Department of Energy. Some are going to come from the Department, from the Development Bank of South Africa, DBSA. But some of them, banks are offering these solutions as a standard solution. If you get a solar water heater, you would pay less, and all you would pay the bank is the amount that you were supposed to pay for a given period. So there are other standard options, but there are different sources. What has been provided here for now is the 260, the other 750 over the four-year period or three-year period that's left now is going to be sourced from these different. And that you also have to take note that it's 250,000 on ESCOM. It excludes the other 50% that would come from the municipalities. So if you look at that combination, you may even have your 500,000. Municipalities have the ability to add a surcharge. The city of Joburg, city power, adds 2%, and they are using that for installing their ones. Ekurhuleni, Tshwane, city of Cape Town. So there are funds that are collected from other ends. What is required is the coordination of that to have the million solar water heaters. So the million is going to come from those combinations. But if it were to come from the tariff, it would have been a 40% increase just on that. Yes, 6 billion rand per annum, for 6 billion for 250. Now, 250 times 4 gives you a million, so multiply 6 by 4. That's what it comes to. Then Kusile, yes, is included on this, but what is included on Kusile is the part that ESCOM had applied for. Kusile has been included in the sense that they've been allowed to go and get equity funding up to about 14%, and that's we have included the part that they have to get from their own base. The other 40% we have not included it. So in the 10,000 megawatts going forward, it's Kusile and Medupi. And the other one about Chancellor House, my chairperson will help in that one. And the one about the costs and the agreements that were signed, it's the 8 years. The job losses come from the fact that if you take a percentage point in what you say, if your assumption is that the reduction, if your assumption is that a 25% increase would mean an inflationary or it would mean an increase in inflation by 1, and then you multiply that by that, then you'll get 250. But our indications don't get to the same figures because we don't have that. But we have calculated and the many assumptions that are made to say that jobs will be lost is exactly the point where we said that if you go to 30, that's the tipping point where businesses will close. But if you stay at 25, they will just not have as much profit as they would want to. So those are the chairperson will answer the ones I can't answer.
Thank you. You know, when you are the chair, you get delegated all the difficult things. Clearly, the issue on Chancellor House is beyond our scope, and I wouldn't want to attempt it. But I need to make a few comments on the public hearing and us looking after the poorest. Can you put on my famous slide? 22 minutes. We found, as Bukula had said, that in the hearing, we get educated. One of the fundamental rules in relating to people that use your product is always be in touch with them. And this is a methodology which helps us to be in touch with our end users. In fact, we are now going to do more. We're now going to conduct workshops where, yes, we hear them and we do take the input into consideration, but we also are going to start sharing some information so that we can educate our end users. The reason I like this slide is that it shows very clearly that for the average person who uses the average electricity, they're getting a 10% reduction first year one. In year two, they're getting a 5%. So by 2013, their total price increase on electricity is 5.5%. And if you look at the average person without swimming pools and all of that, by the year 2013, the price increase will be 13.5%. So with that, I really do think that we have looked after the poor of the poor. Yes, I accept that the challenge is going to be the implementation at municipality level. But as Thembani was saying, we're going to go one step further in trying to monitor whether this increase reaches the person that we intended to. It is a challenge with the municipalities, and we will work through the challenges. But it's something that we've committed ourselves that we would like to go, and the people that came to our hearing, I still want to go and see the lady that presented to us, who's running a hospice in Kwamashu, and say to her, how are you doing? How has it affected you? Because I need to bring that back to the table and say, Bukula, you remember that lady? She has not got it, so what can we do? And I do bore them with those. There's a role that we have to play. Thank you.
It's a very brief comment, very, very brief, which may be controversial as well. But I think it's important, Chair, when answering the question as to whether does NESA look at contracts that ESCOM enters into. First of all, we need to understand both ESCOM and ourselves are created, in fact, are included in the schedule of PFMA, Public Finance Management Act, which we are governed by. We are Schedule 3A public entity, ESCOM is Schedule 2. And as a Schedule 2, they've got a board, and they've got an executive authority, who's the minister. So that is the part of procurement. That is the route it takes. However, if an entity, Mr. Bukula has just identified the Bethlehem Hydro, if Bethlehem Hydro comes and applies for a license, then we as a regulator do interrogate their ownership structure. We do that. In any license that we grant, we make sure that you comply with the preferential treatment, triple P, BEE. That is our job when we grant a license. However, when ESCOM procures, it's not our job. Our job is to make sure that in building Kusile, the levelized cost of a megawatt is within a particular range internationally. So we do that benchmarking. I think I must just explain that, Chair, because it's very important to differentiate the issues of governance on the one hand and those of regulatory, which we are included in, Chair. The final point, Chair, I know the Chair has indicated this, but Chair, I think I'm a child and you are more knowledgeable than me. We're a constitutional democracy. And as a constitutional democracy, there are certain things that are required by the Constitution. One of which is that people need to be heard. Whoever is going to be affected by a decision, we as a regulator, as an administrative body, are required to hear their views before we make that decision. In that context, public hearings are very important. But there are other contexts which are very important for people in this country, particularly the education element. If we were to go back and do a dipstick survey and see how much people do understand on issues of electricity, I'm sure we'd find something different. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. That was the first round. And the time is it 5 past or 10 past 12? And we still have one item that we have to deal with as a committee. But I think from the first round, to me, it has covered a lot of issues that are quite issues that we wanted to hear as the portfolio committee. If we need to have further engagement with NERSA, I think we can look at a program. If we feel, because to me, we feel to, we need to do that so that we can discuss a lot of these things, not under pressure by time, or maybe start the meeting 9 o'clock to 1 flat, or just a workshop the whole day or whatever, so that we can be able, as we move on to whatever implementation strategies and processes, I think all of us are taken on board in terms of the process. That is very, very important to me, because at the end of the day, even if you are not NERSA, as a committee member, you get asked some questions. And keep on saying, I think is NERSA doing, I think is whatever. You are an entity that reports to us. We need them to know exactly the pros and cons of what leads to a final decision or recommendation. But I think it's like passing the legislation. Not everybody will be happy with the legislation you pass, but we try by all means not to to hurt the majority of the poor or those people who can afford. The affordability of whatever we do always comes to the fore, which are the majority of the citizens. But at the end of the day, some of the processes, I'm sure as members, we need to look at and see whether there are issues that need review, or if you feel the hearings are not okay. But remember, I'm not sure how many times government get taken to court just on the process. Just on the process that the public is not happy because they are not adequately consulted in terms of our constitution now currently. So democracy at times is not cheap, it's expensive. And it's things like this one that you have to pay hearings, do whatever, but let's discuss those in broad terms and try to have a second round of the engagement with NERSA. I think that will help us. But I think for now, because we're too edgy, I mean to get to understand as to what led to the recommendation or decision. But by now, I'm sure we are much more better. And you did well. That's why I wish you luck. And really, that helped, because I think given the questions and what you answered, and I must say the majority of the responses were quite frank and honest. And that is what we would like to encourage, in order that you can then build this good relationship. Otherwise, I would then thank NERSA, through the leadership of the chair, etc., and the team. You'll hear from us, but definitely we need some more discussions and engagement, because to us, you play a very key role. If we talk renewable energy, NERSA deals with a lot of regulatory issues that we believe are some of the things going forward we need to discuss a lot. So in that, we thank you very much. And if you want to stay to hear the deliberations on the third plan and the budget, you are free to do so. But if you've got other engagements, you can then be released. Hope to see you next time soon, after we discuss in the committee when to have you back. Thanks. Members, I'm not sure, but I think we need about 1 minute or 2 minutes break for human rights. But if people are keen to stay next, thank you. Thank you for attending. I've been late to the memorial service. But at the same time, you must deal with this piece of work, unfortunately. I see Mr. Apani and Asemola and Apani are here from the department representing DOE. Firstly, for members, I'm sure you received a copy of the report in your pigeonholes. But before we consider that report, my recollection is that there were issues that were raised, and we asked the department to go back and come back to us before we can consider this report. And as such, I'm expecting them then to deal with that before we can then deal with the report. Is that the same understanding that all the members, we are in one?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, I'm glad that that is the understanding. Can we then give then the department then to respond back to those issues that were raised so that we can move forward? I'm not sure who's going to start. I see Carter DDGs and other officials from the department joining us. But bear in mind that we don't have all the time. There's a memorial service that is going to be started at about 12:30. And the time is 20 past 12. Sure. 10 minutes left for the memorial service then to start. Can I hand over then to the department, whoever is doing the presentation? Responding to the issues.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Good afternoon, Chairperson and members of the Portfolio Committee. My name is Tidiso Makubela. I'm the DDG responsible for hydrocarbons and energy planning at the Department of Energy. First of all, I'd like to thank the committee for the opportunity to come before yourself to come and present on the issues as we have received guidance. I'd like to apologize for on behalf of the minister who's accompanying the president to the Nuclear Security Summit in Washington, and also apologize for the DG who has a personal medical emergency in the family. I think I will leave it at that at this stage, Chair. I'm here with the senior management of the department, Mr. Apane, who has been here since this morning, acting DDG for electricity and nuclear and clean energy, Mr. Masemula, head of the electrification program, Mr. Mkize, head of hydrocarbons, Mr. Mavuso, head of licensing. I see he's not in the room at the moment. And then next to me is Mr. Subramani, who is heading the planning, energy planning directorate. From the guidance that we received, Chairperson, the presentation is in two parts. The presentation on the commitments that were made, which each DDG will go through, and then there is then a brief overview on the solar water heater program. Now, Chair, I would need guidance as to which one we can start with, given the time constraints, so that we can zoom in on the one that the committee is mostly interested in. Okay. Okay. Chairperson, the guidance that we received was that we should come and indicate where we are in relation to the commitments that were made in last year's budget vote speech. And for that, we have listed the commitments that were made. And Mr. Mkize will talk to the hydrocarbons issues, and Mr. Apane then will follow and talk to the electricity, nuclear, and clean energy issues. Thank you. Over to you. I think
think there is the people who are coming with the copies. We were told that they were going to be called by our parliamentary officer when the other presentation is finished. I think they are delayed. But this, the one, the Solomon.
Thank you, Chair. Honorable members, I will take you through the electricity, nuclear, and clean energy aspects of the commitment, and I will also zoom in on the solar water heating program. Just in terms of the commitment, the commitments, I'm going to start with the solar water heating program. And in the interest of time, we have about 12 slides on it, and I will just flesh out the most critical elements in it. I won't go into a lot more detail. But if I can also ask you to follow the presentation that I have handed out, the hard copy will give a lot more details than that. Excuse me. As you might recall, we made a commitment in 2009, last year, that we would roll out 1 million solar water heaters in households and commercial buildings over a period of 5 years. The background is that we had intended to roll out the 1 million solar water heaters by within 4 years as a political target, but also recognizing that the actual upside is 6 million households out there that are connected to the grid that we need to divert. Now, the presentation, whilst Mr. Masemola is loading that on solar water heating, briefly will indicate what the implementation model entails, what the program has yielded so far, what the targets are on a disaggregated basis. We will do some market segmentation so that you can see where the potential lies, and then lastly reflect on what we have achieved over the past 8 months or so in that regard. Sorry, Chair, we're just trying to load the... Okay. Yes. Okay, Chair. The objectives of the solar water heating program are to reduce the electricity demand and to ensure better utilization of the resources that we have. As you are very aware, in January last year, we hit some supply-demand problems, you had to go into a blackout situation, and this program is largely aimed at removing most of the water heating load from the electricity grid. We also are aware of the need and the opportunity to create jobs due to this intervention. There was some discussion earlier this morning about the potential to create jobs through, if you like, the in the climate change space, for lack of a better word. We're wanting to diversify our energy mix. This is a very big renewable energy and energy efficiency intervention. And obviously it impacts the carbon footprint positively. But I think for the consumer, it also will have very positive impact from a financial perspective. The discussion earlier this morning around how you're going to cushion the poor and so on needs to be, you know, contextualized in terms of a broader scope of activities that might not necessarily be in relation to free basic electricity, but as people start reaping the benefits due to this kind of program, it would also reduce the burden on the poor and on the domestic user generally. Chair, I won't dwell on this one, but what we have done is we have disaggregated the segments, and as you can see there, there are about, shall we say, 7 or 8 potential market segments that we believe can be dealt with differently. We're saying market segments, and we're saying that we're going to deal with them differently, because as you can appreciate, it's not a one-size-fits-all kind of approach that applies, and I'll elaborate on why there are different nuances in relation to those segments. What are those segments? By and large, we're trying to mitigate increasing demand, and therefore the so-called high LSM segment, right? LSM meaning a living standards measure. I'm sure you might be familiar with what that means. But it's really the high-income households. And so we drill down. Just in terms of numbers, is that perhaps the biggest opportunity is in what we call the middle to low-income market, where there's about 3.5 million households, 3.55 million households. The upside here is this represents low-hanging fruit in the sense that the houses are largely similar in build, in similar in orientation, and so we're talking about townhouse complexes, gap and bonded houses under the government subsidy scheme, and so on. In the interest of time, I'm not going to go into the detail because I think we come back to that. Oopsie. This is no good. Okay, if you can just follow this in terms of your presentation in front of you, I think it's a better copy than what shows here. But the regulator did indicate that there has been some allocation in the MYPD for energy efficiency, cogeneration, and renewable energy interventions. In particular, solar water heating is one of those, and they gave a number, I think about 200,000 systems that are going to be funded through this program. We do not necessarily agree with the regulator around that because we believe that there's been a number of assumptions about economies of scale. We do not believe that the capital cost of a system will not decrease as you install more and more. So the assumption, you know, needs to be borne in mind, the fact that they have assumed the same capital cost that Eskom has assumed. We believe you can leverage a lot more than what has been allowed as the prices, or rather as we install more and more. That's the first one. And then secondly is that we believe that a standard offer approach would be most appropriate. As the regulator indicated earlier this morning, what used to happen in the past is that they would take a risk, or Eskom would take the risk around a demand-side management intervention like what they did in the Western Cape in 2006, and it was not sustainable. So we're saying here you would attract a rebate as long as you have a heater, a solar water heater on your roof, on a longer than once-off basis. So we don't fund the installation, we fund the life cycle cost in relation to a geyser, and therefore it would be in drips and drabs, so to speak. I think that's all I want to say about this. Oh, sorry, it does.
Love it. Chair, but if I may very quickly, is that the money has been approved in the MYPD, as you heard this morning, and basically what we're doing is we're putting in place an agency, the National Energy Efficiency Agency, which would serve as a repository for all the installations, and this is where the rebate program is going to be run from. We're going to register all those interventions so that we're able to then see how we are performing in relation to targets that have been set and costs and so on. Carbon emissions is one of the benefits that we're wanting to derive out of this this program. It is, and then the last point is that it is largely based on an ESCO model, and an ESCO model means that you would create a whole lot of small and medium enterprises which would make those interventions in a system that is not controlled by ESCOM. ESCOM just happens to be the wholesale aggregator in the scheme. If there's any questions, we can go into town around that. If I move on, Chair, I have mentioned that we're targeting the high LSM segment as an energy efficiency, or rather as a balancing approach for the grid. But I believe in this country there are hundreds of thousands of geysers that the insurance industry replaces as the geysers fail, and we're wanting to take advantage of that. In terms of the public buildings, government owns something like 100,000 buildings which are not necessarily energy efficient. We regard it as low-hanging fruit. But for solar water heating, it's largely the hospitals, you know, the overnight kind of facilities where people sleep that are currently using electricity for water heating. And then there's also, I've mentioned, the 3.55 million, which is the medium to low. And then the most controversial one, Chair, and that relates to the fact that there is a saying that even elephants use hot water, that please don't get the sense that this is targeted only at the high LSMs and the rich, but the fact that even those people that do not have electricity are not grid connected, they would still use firewood and other unwanted kind of carriers to heat their water. So this program does include those. It is not necessarily a demand side, or rather an electricity supply demand balance issue in the short term, but it definitely is an environmental issue that we are addressing head on. So this program is not only funded from the electricity tariff, MYPD as the regulator indicated, but it's also funded from the fiscals. Unfortunately, the fiscals is not as deep as what we would have wanted. So contrary to what other countries do, our program from the fiscals ends in 2013. We're just indicating the 30,000 systems that will be installed out of the fiscals in the next financial year. It will be largely undertaken under the ESCOM program. In terms of outcomes, we indicated that this is a five-year program starting last year, but that it does not necessarily stop after 5 years. I enjoyed the comment by one of the members that this is the most quickly deployable intervention, but it's also the cheapest option that we have, so it would be foolhardy to limit it to $1 million. The idea is that it would extend over the next 10 years and cover all 6 to 7 million houses, as indicated there. So that's the rollout program, but this graph indicates that from around year six, we will be installing about 800,000 plus systems a year. The point about that, Chair, is that you remember we mentioned the issue about jobs and so on, and as we might also be aware, most of the systems are imported, and we would like to limit after year one, the extent to which imported solar home systems are used in the rebate program. We want you to insist that after the first 200,000 are installed through the DTI and those kind of mechanisms, we would stop the import. Well, not necessarily stop, but limit the extent to which imported systems would be funded from this program. I won't go into the detail here, but this shows the disaggregated interventions. In other words, to show the portfolio on a year, 4-year basis, and it covers everything from high income to government buildings to low income to non-connected households. So you can read that at leisure. Just in terms of jobs, this is another outcome. We believe that this might be able to, and this is a very subjective issue, but we have some economists do some projections on the direct jobs, incidentally, we're not talking about indirect jobs, in relation to this program. And as you can see, they're at the peak after about six years. We're hoping to create 12,000 direct permanent quality jobs. In terms of the multiplier effects and so on, the number that is normally bandied about is around 10 times that, so up to about 120,000 jobs could be created in the industry generally. I won't dwell on the CO2 savings. Suffice it to say that as we do that, we would also reduce our carbon emissions footprint. As you heard earlier this morning about the World Bank loan, one of the issues that was uncomfortable from a let's grant the loan point of view was that it would continue to, we would continue to be a high emitting country. And one of the arguments that we countered this position on was the fact that we have a whole lot of other, if you like, carbon reducing initiatives. And this was one of those that I think assisted us. Just in terms of electricity savings, the regulator indicated this morning that, for example, we have a shortfall of about 10 terawatt hours. We believe that we might be able to do exactly that within a very short space of time. If we install 1 million geysers in the next 4 years, our estimates are that we would be able to reduce. I mean, and the argument here is that 30% of domestic electricity use is on water heating and related activities. So you can imagine the 10 million households that are connected that use electricity, and we remove 6 million of those, just how much electricity savings we're going to achieve. Thank you very much, Chair, as far as that one is concerned. Chair, maybe to, I don't know if we are ready with the overall presentation, but that was one of the promises that we made in last year's budget speech, and I will also indicate that in relation to most of the others, we have achieved the targets that we had set for ourselves. There might be one or two things, particularly on the nuclear side, that might not have been completely achieved yet, but the summary is that in relation to what we set out to do last year in our threat plan, we have achieved that. If I can hand over back to my colleague.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Once again, apologies for the delay in the copies. It's a matter that I can assure you we will deal with when we gather as a team. As I indicated, Chairperson, the first part of the commitment, Mr. Mkhize will address that, and then Mr. Apane will then continue with the rest of the commitment. I must indicate up front that the difficulty that we had in compiling the information here was that some of or an elaboration on where we are had already been included as part of the minister's report back to Parliament, which is scheduled for next week. But we will give as much information to the committee. So if I can just hand over to Mr. Mkhize. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you, Chair. Thanks, CDC. Thank you, members of the House. Concerning the revision of the National Strategic Field Stock Policy, the department has finalized its work in the document, and we are currently in consultation with other government departments for input prior to us sending it over to the to cabinet. The IEP, we didn't get funding last year. The funding that we received was only late for the modeling, which in fact has been received in this financial year. With regard to new fuel standards and specifications, we did assemble the interdepartmental task team. We have convened several meetings. We have had consultations with SAPIA as well as NAMSA, and now we will have a joint meeting with them prior to finalizing the document for internal approval. And we still think that we are on course for the due date we've set upon ourselves for this financial year to announce. And then when it comes to the SANEDI, South African National Energy Development Institute to conduct energy research and development, the business plan is at Treasury in DPSA. We are awaiting approval from the two ministers so that we can proceed with the process. The review of the liquid fuels charter, in fact, when it comes to that review, the review is only going to take place this year, actually. I don't know how come this was featuring in, but we're going to review the charter as part of also the review of the Petroleum Products Act itself. That's all from my side. Thank you.
So if I can continue from there, the National Radioactive Waste Disposal Institute was established by December last year, and the Act was promulgated. What we're busy doing now is to create the board of holding the board of directors and to operationalize that. It just also indicates what this institute is supposed to do. Regarding the conversion of Safari, that has been done, as you might well be aware. In fact, the president is in the U.S. as we speak, and he was lauded for having achieved that. I've touched on the issue of the solar water heating program. In fact, what I might have omitted to mention regarding the solar water heating program is that as we speak, 7,000 are currently being installed in a project that will be launched by the president this weekend. Regarding the in Winterfeld, Tony. Yes. Regarding the pronouncement of the appropriate energy mix, as you might be aware, last year we promulgated IRP1, whereas the intention was to promulgate a wider reaching IRP. And we had specifically limited the IRP to addressing the ESCOM MYPD program. There is a process underway to conclude IRP over a 25-year program. Regarding collaboration with the Clinton Foundation, which was another issue that we raised, we have concluded a pre-feasibility process in terms of which the minister will be making some announcement in the budget speech next week on that one. So please, if I can take your indulgences. Regarding the commissioning of 400 megawatts of wind power, this is the one where we've had some problems, but I think about a month ago, the Minister of Public Enterprises announced that ESCOM is ready to conclude the cogeneration and the IPP projects that have been put on the table, and as we speak, they're currently being executed. I've mentioned the one about the integrated resource plan, and then the issue about the displacement of 5% of crude oil-based fuels with biofuels. I think that's one of the ones that we have not had success on, largely because the dollar price of oil has declined to such an extent that we've had to review the strategy as to how we're going to introduce that biofuels mix going forward.
regarding electrification projects, those specific projects have been currently, have they been concluded? Yeah, the 170 million program in Mobile and in the in Temba, those have been launched and they have actually been concluded as we speak. The signing of DFM contracts with municipalities and ESCOM for specific energy efficiency program. I just mentioned the energy, the solar water heating program, but there has been a massive program to exchange exchange incandescent with compact fluorescent lights, and that is was successfully delivered. In fact, as we speak, to date there's been about 40 million that have been installed. Last year alone, in Tswane, ESCOM installed some 1.8 million, so the program is very successful. An appropriate pricing policy framework to structure our tariff regime. Chair, this also relates to the discussion that was had earlier with the regulator, is the fact that that is a tariff rationalization process under the EDI restructuring program. It becomes very difficult to reach municipal tariff structuring for those reasons relating to the constitution. And as you might also be aware, there is a process to try and address that through an amendment or some specific nuance in the constitution to deal with that. And we're waiting the development on that one. Thank you.
Chairperson, that concludes the presentation. I must admit that we were very brief. However, we did have, as I indicated, a bit of a challenge between balancing, the report back of the minister and what we are able to present to the committee. But that is the status on the commitment that were made.
Okay, I don't know why you are having that challenge, because we're asking just simple questions that you want, because there's no way that you can adopt a budget that we don't have a clue as to what is it that is going to do adequately. I mean, there's no such, and we are not a rubber stamp portfolio committee, and I'm sure you know now, committees have got more powers to maintain, run a business, including the budget. So I don't know where is this thing of what the minister is going to report about. We cannot share with us, because we're asking according to a set plan that you put here, not our set plan. It is the department's set plan. So surely we need to get a sense of where issues are. If we have installed 7,000 solar water heaters, but you hope that you'll be able to install 200,000. Good luck, because this is what is here. 200,000 for this financial year, the other one 300, the other one 500. So I'm not sure whether you've taken figures, you just put them or whatever, but to me I find very strange the relationship with the production or what you'll need at the end without much more. But you've given us at least some of the answers that you wanted at the last meeting. So I'll hear from members' response in terms of what has been presented. Silau, Khreile, and we move on.
Chairperson, just two, I think, simple questions. One is relating to the solar heater program. There are currently solar heaters being implemented in the different localities. I think here in Cape Town, around Khayelitsha and so on. How are they related to the 1 million program? That is the first question. The second question is, in the presentation by NERSA, I got the impression that it is more expensive to make use of renewable energy as compared to the coal energy that we currently use. And how do we intend using that energy without incurring more expenses?
Yeah, thank you, Chair. I noticed under your hydrocarbons and energy planning branch, you didn't include the development of an integrated resource plan, but I presume you are still going ahead with that. I know you've got an integrated energy plan, but and I'll be interested to hear the timelines as well, because as far as I understood, the documents were supposed to come in about the middle of April, the draft documents in terms of the integrated resource plan, and then open for consultation. If you could just give me some insight into what that timeline is. The other thing you haven't included also is a review of the renewable energy white paper. Is that process still going ahead as well? And also, I mean, there was a concern that it's not being coordinated with the IRP. I mean, I think it would make sense to run these two processes concurrently, because obviously the one feeds into the other. So I'm just interested to hear how those two fit together. And just on the solar water heaters, I mean, look, there's major comments that can be made there. I mean, I think it's certainly welcome the fact that you're given a greater priority. I mean, I know they're not very sexy, but in actual fact, I think they're one of the most important development tools for our country right now going forward. And I think the problem that we've had in the past was that we set targets of 1 million within 3 years, and we only delivered 2,500 within 2 years. The key here is about getting the right model to get these things out there. And, I mean, are we assured that we are actually going to reach these timelines? Can we hold you accountable to this? And can we hold Eskom accountable as well? Because, I mean, they've been given the money for 260,000 solar water heaters, and their rebate system really didn't deliver. I mean, my personal opinion is that we should actually take that money away from Eskom, put it into the Energy Efficiency Agency, and run it there. There shouldn't be a demand-side management tool. There should be an actual job creation energy production tool. I mean, this really should be driven by somebody who's not in the energy business as such, and rather by an outside agency. So I'm just interested to hear your opinion on that. And then lastly, on the solar water heaters, I mean, it's interesting to hear you say that you're going to change the rebate system, that it's not going to be a kind of one-off payment up front, that it's going to be paying for that. Is this going to be applied retrospectively? And the reason why I ask that is because I installed my solar water heater last year, and obviously I did it at the lower rebate, and in fact I didn't even get the rebate because they said that it's cheaper not to do it. So will you be looking at that? Because what a lot of people do is they hold back because they keep hearing there's going to be new announcements, new rebates, new things, and so your first take is obviously get a disincentive to actually act first. So how are you going to deal with that particular issue? Thanks.
Who do you represent? Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you for the information that you brought us. I would like to know what made biofuel to not to succeed. My other question is about this, the money owed by Eskom by other municipalities. I don't know, because I just want to know about this trust funds, where people are putting their money into a trust and not paying the municipalities. How is Eskom going to recover that money or make these people pay the municipality so that Eskom can have funds?
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I think we can talk about very beautiful things. I hear earlier about NEASA people, education is very important and all those things. I think on the solar heater issue, I think the awareness campaign must be come up, part of your program. When you actually, so that people, the poor people can be aware that there's that program, so that they actually can also, if they have that period where the same people can apply or whatever, they can get less than a price. So I think this thing must be happening. Thank you very much.
Thank you, President.
I will ask Mr. Apane to respond, or in fact, all the questions in the his domain. What I can just indicate is a question that was asked by Honorable Freiling on the IEP and IRP interface. If members look at the strategic plan of the department as presented, we had foreseen a situation where the IRP would take a longer period. That has since been revised due to intervention from the committee as well as our principals. We now have a shorter period to deliver the IEP, and we have committed to do it within that period. And in terms of the IRP too, what I can indicate is that it's all systems go there. We still are convinced that we will be able to meet the commitments that were made. Just to indicate perhaps the timeline, we now have a date of end of the financial year for the IEP. But if you look at the strat plan, there was an additional year. But of course, we listened to the interventions that were made during the presentation, and we have made adjustments. We have procured, acquired new additional human resources to actually accelerate the process. Of course, that doesn't mean that the consultation process will be sacrificed in the process. But what it means is that we will have less time within the department to really come up with a draft plan for consultation. But I'll leave Mr. Apane then to answer the questions on electricity that were asked.
If I can start here with the one on the renewable energy being more expensive and how we intend to deal with it in the context of solar water heating. The short answer is that the renewable energy, or rather solar water heating, is probably double-sided on that in terms of benefits, because not only is it a renewable energy, but it just coincides with it being a very efficient and cheap demand-side management too. So we're not looking at it as a renewable energy option per se. It is a demand side management option, and demand side management is always cheaper than building the next power station. So the fact that it happens to be cleaner as well, it's renewable and so on, is a double benefit. But I suppose the question is broader than just solar water heating, Chair, and I'm not sure if it's entirely correct that renewable energy is more expensive because those in the know will tell you about externalities and how to factor them into the actual economic cost rather than narrow financial cost. So I suppose from a regulatory point of view, what you heard this morning was that they are looking at it with a particular perspective in mind, as other, not from a broader perspective. A very controversial subject, Chair, but if I can just leave it at that. We definitely are reviewing the Renewable Energy White Paper, and yes, the issue of coordination with the integrated resource planning process is a challenge that we have identified, and in fact, as we speak, there is a process to address that. We will be pronouncing this week as to how we're going to engage with the different stakeholders and how it all is going to fit in. It's not just the renewable energy space, but it's also how this deals with import, nuclear, cogeneration, and the works, which is the process to deal with that. The problem with solar, if I can now go back to solar, because I think the rest of the other
projects or questions related to solar water heating except for biofuels and municipalities. The issue about the solar water heating program, and Chair, I appreciate your comment about 7,000 and then suddenly 200,000, is that what has been the problem in the past is that there has not been any funding for solar water heating, period. But that happened also in the context of an extremely low electricity tariff. So there was absolutely no driver to save electricity because you could pay for it. Now, as the price or the tariff increases, people are suddenly going to see the business case to try and reduce. As the tariff increases, that case for saving electricity is going to become even more compelling because, you know, the necessary economic signals are going to be sent. So that was the problem. And what happened is that we had a very disparate approach to it. Eskom ran a program, SEF ran a program, some municipalities that had money tried to do it, and it was all flawed because, for example, in the Eskom context, the rebate was just not attractive enough. You had to pay 80% and they carried 20%. Why should I do that when I have installed electric geyser already? What we have now is a massified program that is funded on the basis of opportunity cost. In simple language, what it means is that we are building a power station to heat all the water in this country, and everybody gets that. We give it out largely for free. That's the difference. We're not asking for an 80% payment. We're not asking the fiscal to pay for it. We're saying it's cheaper to do that than to burn the additional coal that is required to heat the water. So that argument is a well-established one, and that's why you will see that, you know, the program can then get off the ground. Why it will get off the ground again now is that, don't forget, it's only March, or is it February this year? I think it was in March that the regulator confirmed MYPD2 and the fact that there is now an allowance in it for solar water heating. Before that, there was absolutely no funding. So that's why we believe that programs like what had been done in Khayelitsha were really, you know, struggling along because of the problem. But once you start funding it en masse like this, it'll take off. The problem that we have, Chair, is actually not the fact that you will jump from 7,000 to 200,000 a year. It's the fact we could even jump to 200,000 because everybody is out there waiting to dump their product in this country. And that's what we're actually trying to watch. We're trying to limit the extent to which we will accept product from overseas and try and create the jobs and the training and the capacity and the technology locally. In terms of now how this is going to relate to those that have already installed the solar water heating before, unfortunately, it's not retrospective, is the fact that you will only reap the benefit in relation to the savings that you will achieve. But it does not stop those that have solar water heating, additional solar water heating requirements to participate in this program. Incidentally, what we also intend to do is to disaggregate the, you know, there is the sense that things that you give for free don't get looked after. We will definitely be connecting, like we do with electrification, we'll be collecting a connection fee for every system that's installed. And there will be differentiation. So, Honorable Clayton, unfortunately, your connection fee will be higher than the one that accrues in because of the, I think that's the kind of differentiation that we're wanting to introduce. Then the issue about the, excuse me, the communities and awareness program. Honorable Moss, well said. I think that it's perhaps one of the biggest risks that we run, where we think we understand what we're doing, but nobody else understands, and we don't communicate. So I think we will take that into account. And what that education entails, I suppose, needs to go beyond just the, you know, the advertising and so on. In terms of the biofuels program, and Mr. McQuarrie might have to assist me here, but it goes like this. When the petrol price or the U.S. dollar price of oil was at $100 and more a few years ago, the case for the
diesel with a biofuel component was very compelling because the economics around it was a lot more better in relation to creating the job, planting the crop, creating the job, changing the regulations, and then facilitating the introduction. Now that what we have seen, particularly over the past 2 years, and certainly with the economic downturn, was that the dollar price declined, and we have not been able to then make the economic case for introducing biofuels. But what we are doing at the moment is to revisit the regulatory space. So from a liquid fuel regulatory perspective, we're trying to say, look, there needs to be a certain, because that's what the Brazilians and them do, to see if we can't provide a certain, if you like, regulatory signal. A certain percentage must be allowed for blended products. What the details are, Mr. Matuela and Mr. Mkhize can possibly address, but certainly from our perspective, you can appreciate, we're just looking to see it, we see it as a renewable energy issue that would also assist in mitigating climate change issues. Chair, there was a question about a specific instance where trusts are formed to avoid paying municipalities and what we can do in that regard. We have a program under the distribution sector. Okay, let's start with energy efficiency. When the tariffs go up, you need to do everything that you can to ensure that it does not adversely impact, you know, those that are paying their tariff. And one of the things that we're looking at, apart from energy or over and above energy efficiency, is what is called non-technical losses. In other words, the losses that obtain, not because of technical reasons, but simply because people steal electricity, they're not paying their rates, and so on, because we believe there's a lot of potential to spread the benefit, as it were. And the issue of payment and how to facilitate programs that would improve, you know, revenue collection capacity at municipal level is the thing, well, it's one of the interventions that we're going to be making. But it also has some legal connotations around it, because I don't think it's actually legal to not pay your dues for the service that has been rendered. So we're very limited as to what we can do in order to address that problem completely. I think that's about all the questions. Yeah.
The only question that you never answered properly is the question of the electrification of houses. So how many were able to do last year? And this 150, is it desirable, or you're just putting the figures?
I'm going to ask my colleague who runs the electrification.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, honourable members. Let me start with the 150. The 150,000 connections that we are currently doing and that we are projecting every year, it's what can basically be made from the available funding. I do have a detailed information on that, in terms of the numbers that we have done to date. So with the current level of funding, we can only do 450,000 connections for every 3 years, and purely because the first is the money. Secondly, it's because the cost per connection, especially in the rural areas, is very expensive. In areas where we have to build more bulk infrastructure as well to enable connections. So that is basically the thing. In order to be able to do three times or twice that amount, we need to have almost twice the current budget. So the current budget is about 3 billion rand. In order to be able to basically do twice that, we need about 6.2 billion. And in order to reach universal access by 2012, we will need from now until 2012 at least 26 billion rand when you add the bulk infrastructure and everything that has got to do with it. So we can only do 150 with the current level of funding. I must indicate that in the KZN, Eastern Cape, and the Limpopo, that is where our major challenges are in terms of rural electrification. So in terms of the progress that we had, by the end of February, we have done about 122,000. Eskom was supposed to do 98,000. They have done 74,000. So we do meet the target every year of the 150. Sometimes we do more. Maybe additional 5,000 or so with the money. So by the end of February, they were 74,000 of the 98. So the March report, when it comes, they will probably have completed the remainder of the connection. The municipalities were the ones which were a bit behind, but it's understandable because they are financial year. They were at about 63% expenditure. So it's by February. So by March, we have transferred 98% of the funding, but they still have got 3 months because their financial year starts 3 months after the our financial year, the national financial year. So we normally expect them to complete their program by June. They have that 3 months to be able to finalize all their connections. All their projects at that time had already commenced, except with some small pockets, where there are challenges and so on. But in general, municipalities, they are basically doing well. Thank you. Let me explain. The Integrated National Electrification Program is divided into two. The grants to ESCOM and grants to municipalities. So in the Division of Revenue, it will be Schedule 6, which is the municipal, and Schedule 7, which is the ESCOM. Now, the municipalities are those who are licensed and they have the capacity to implement the electrification program. And in areas where municipalities don't have the capacity and the license, obviously, to distribute electricity, and which, in this case, is largely rural municipalities, ESCOM is executing that program. So that money is gazetted like that. So when we report to Treasury, we will have a municipal report, Schedule 6 report, and Schedule 7 report. So what I indicated was that on the ESCOM side, we have transferred all the money, and then by the end of February, they had 74,000 connections. On the municipal program, we have just transferred all their money now, about 98% by the end of March. So their program in terms of expenditure by February, it was 63%, which we believe that it is very good in terms of the fact that they still have got from February, they still have got 4 months until June to complete their program.
Okay. I think now you are sparking more discussions and whatever, and I don't think we've got all the time to do that. But the bottom line is that we are not going to reach the universal access with the current model of budget, and also not the MDG, then, because that is one of the issues. So to me, that's the bottom line. Out of all what you explained, that sparked a lot of discussion, but you don't have time to do that now. And I'm worried because the time is just ticking by. It's almost past one. Members, do you have any other issue after the explanation?
some issues are for discussion further, etc., but generally on issues that are raised. Not entirely happy with the response, I must say it, but I'm not sure committee members after getting this input today. What is your take? My brother.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I just want to check with the department on the electrification. They are speaking about only 150,000 houses. And in their last report, there was a electrification of schools, and where they didn't even indicate how many schools are left. Last year, there was a list of all provinces and the outstanding numbers of the electrification. Now, in this year's report, the committee said by June this year they will be finished. So we don't know now what was the progress from last year up to now, and I don't know whether by June 2010 will they really make it, because in that report there was no figures. It was just by 2010 June they would be finished. And the other question is on the this free basic electricity. In the last year, there was a list from the municipalities that had not that were not complying with this regulation. Now, I just want to check with the committee: is there any progress on that? Because the NEFSA this morning has made a commitment that they will make sure out of this 184 municipality, they will check the implementation of this free basic electricity. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you,
I'll respond on the issue of schools and maybe touch on the FBA. The information that we have given that we will do the schools by June, it is our commitment that we'll do that. And the reason we basically said June is because we long have started with the implementation part. We basically had some delays last year in the construction and so on and so on and so on. But the funding that we are basically completing those schools is not the 2009-10 funding. It is the money that we had to be able to eradicate that specific backlog for all schools which are eligible for electrification. So our target still basically remained. So I must indicate that, of course, there will be schools which are not eligible for electrification, and those are the schools that we have engaged with the Department of Education, and they have indicated that they will be merging those schools. Either it's a mud school, they will be demolishing it and building another one, so that we are not going to electrify. But we are constantly in discussion with them in terms of which schools we must electrify and which ones we must not. But in terms of construction, most of those schools that we are doing electrification and on them, the construction has basically commenced. Yes, it is a continuation. Okay, I don't have the printout with me, but I know that we have already 600 of the schools have been electrified to date of the I think we had about 1,000, so we have done already 600. That's the information from end of February. Yes.
Members, here we are now. We've got the response from all the issues that we raised from the previous meetings, and this should be the last meeting in essence if you want to deal with this budget, with the third plan and the budget. Failing which, if you don't do that, we don't have the budget for Department of Energy, unfortunately, that we support as members of Parliament. So we have then to discuss the question of, are we happy with what we have been given today as a response or not. And then in that, then we'll be able to look at, I'm sure there's a draft report that we'll receive. What is your take on that? Does it cover everything that is here or it doesn't, before we come to the process of adopting the report, if we adopt the report? Can I have indication? Yes, more.
I propose to adopt the report.
To adopt the report. First, are we happy with the explanation on those issues that we asked them? Yes or not? Then we move forward.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Steve.
Mota?
Chair, yes, I think most of the issues that we raised were covered. There were just a little gaps here and there that we're trying to clarify here. So I think on the basis of that, we should go with the report, because if we don't have a baseline for the department, and that's critical for us to have something to work with at the beginning. And I think we can hammer them a lot more next year than this year.
Why do you want to spare them this year? You know that you must teach them a lesson now.
I think they have heard, ma'am. I think the hammering.
Yeah. And to me, I don't agree with the recommendations. Maybe we can go to a vote. And those who say yes, raise up their hands. Those who say no, I'll go with those that are saying no.
No,
that's why you're making a mistake. As a chair with powers vested in me, I can veto you whatever and then decide on what to do as a committee. That's where now you don't understand all my powers that are vested in me that I can exercise right now. Kwele? Hey, don't laugh, Kwele, man. Say something.
Well, I think you're speaking of me, but no, I'm at a bit of a disadvantage because I wasn't there for the entire strategic planning workshop, so I don't know all of the issues that were covered. I think my concern with this department is that it's obviously recovering from the fact that it's been split from the Department of Minerals and Energy, and I think that they are trying to build the capacity. I mean, my concerns would be around the budgeting and around whether that capacity has in fact been built. But certainly we see that process taking place. I mean, that's my impression so far. Yeah.
Maybe just to...
Your first comments are career limiting for you in this committee. But the second one, I think, I'm much good. Don't challenge the chair. Mutam.
Thank you, ma'am. I just wanted to make the point that I think I have made very emphatically, and I think other members have made. The budget that the department has is really beyond the stretch. I don't know how they're going to do the things that they say they're going to do. That's really my concern. But they've given us assurance over assurance after assurance that they will do these things. That should be really our concern here.
That's really my issue, and the issue of many of the members, that they are saying things to me that are not attainable. But they keep on saying, no, we'll do it. Come then next year, I'm sure we'll be able then to have what they told us that they're going to have. Fortunately, it's not us, it's you who said that. So we'll be able to hold you accountable, because that's our duty to do the oversight to it. You cannot come here and tell us things that we cannot do. Then down the line, you make excuses. That is not acceptable. So we are holding on you, and we'll be able then to hold you accountable. And then the reporter, I'm not sure of those who went with it. There's a few typographical mistakes, not too many. I've noticed about two or three. But also, there's no recommendations. As we're engaging from the Lagoon Beach Hotel, members were also raising these problems, but also saying what is it that you can do. But I don't see them in the report. I don't know why, from the secretary, why we don't have any of the recommendations here. So I don't know what is it that are going to do then. Should we take this as what? As I'm trying to get the right weight. Why do you take this? As what? As a base, as what? As we had the set plan, we had the budget, and what?
Minutes.
No, it can't be minutes. This is a form of a report, and we are required by the rules of parliament to produce a report, and then we can then be allowed to vote if it's released before the budget vote. And our budget vote is on Tuesday, the 20th. So largely, I think issues are covered. It's only the section of the recommendations that are not here, that we made along as we're moving on. I'm not sure why the secretary couldn't do it. Why, Peter Paul? What happened to those issues that we're raising? We raised the issues, but we also proposed some of our recommendations here. No, we have to adopt this report. We have to adopt this third plan. But you are saying must adopt it and without our recommendation and have a discussion afterwards. Why? No, I told you early in the morning because you wanted us not to have the discussion. You wanted us to just adopt. I said, no, we're not going to do that. We raise issues before, they must talk to those issues before, and then we can deal with this particular issue. So I don't know if you need training on how the rules work of the committees, then we've got to do that, but not here. Because we were just saying we must consider. I said we're not going to consider first. They must respond first from the department, and then we can then have to consider. So don't go back to that particular argument. You do your work as a secretary and you don't become a rep of the department. Mkiti is the one that is a parliamentary liaison officer. That's why then you don't capture things that are supposed to be captured and you keep on doing your consultation with the department. If you love the DOE, you can go and work for DOE. But if you are the committee secretary of energy, you must do the work then of the portfolio committee. Is that clear? Okay, with all that, we'll be able then to adopt the report. We'll deal with some of the recommendations as we engage afterwards. Because after passing the budget, it's not the end that you are, you thought that you have escaped us. We still have to call you back and then further discussions. Yeah, we give you the instruction. We don't need your yes or no. Because you need us most. That you must pass this budget. We don't need you guys. Apan, we don't need you. You need us, right? Yeah?
Yep.
Your yes? I do want it.
Yes, sir.
I won't spoil. I just want to say, Chair, that the team, Team Energy, we are committed, Chair, but I must say that it comes at a price to our own, you know, I don't think anyone in energy is leading a normal life. But, of course, we are committed to what we're committed to. But I think the issue of resources we've made, there are people that have been seconded to the department to ease the burden, but the managers here, they really don't leave the hours that are worked and so on. I'm not exaggerating, Chair. They are just,
okay,
in the long term, not sustainable.
Perfect. Switch off the mic. No, we sympathize with you, but it's equally the same with members of parliament. That you also have extra work to do. We are voted by people to make sure that we implement the policies of the manifesto and others. So we've got no choice. I mean, we've got to do that. And surely we can't just accept a budget that you don't have a clue as to how is it going to be implemented. Which structure can agree to that? Because if you covered all these things initially, we were not going to be sitting here now at 2:00 and then trying to discuss this. With all the challenges, I agree. Not okay, but I'm sure as we move on, things will change, ne? But we will then,
put just a small yana clause there to say we'll further deliberate on some of the recommendations. That is fine. We adopt the report.
Yeah.
Can I have a mover on the consideration of the set plan and of the Department of Energy from members? Matibela?
Yes, I'll second, Chair.
Yeah. And the budget?
Indeed. I will move, Chair, with a huge proviso that we made, and I'd like to support the Chair on this. Those recommendations that we made, we must make sure that we follow up. If they have not been captured, they should be kept up. With that proviso, I would move that we accept it.
You were participating on the ad hoc committee, but Ross and others were part of the. Why you want Matibela and Motau to take the responsibility? Okay, I'm glad that we have reached, but I must say I'm not happy at all. It's not a budget that we adopt and the strategic plan that we adopt happy. But given the circumstances and explanations and the challenges that we also face as a new department, as the Lancet, in that, I mean, we are only adopting this particular set plan and budget. But we are going to hold you accountable, guys. Make no mistake, because we wanted to get the real thing from yourself. You said no, you kept on assuring us. So even if you've got challenges of working overtime and all that, somebody must do the job. We appreciate it's not a good work. But as I said, take it also for us. We are not part of the memorial service. 2 o'clock come, we must be part of the EPCs because of you guys. So equally, somebody must sacrifice. But we hope that from now on we'll have then engagements and presentations, open, frank, and all that, you know, that as we reach towards the report and all that, we are in a better position, and then other budget year, the set plan annually that talks to the 5 year. Then we'll be able then to move forward better.
Thank you very much.
We hope to see you then next week on the 20th.
Yes.
Okay. Thanks. And thanks to NERSA. They've left. They're gone. Thanks to members of the committee for going over time. I'm sure some of us have got high blood sugar, diabetes. Say we must have something to eat before the EPCs. But thank you very much. Thanks for the cooperation and the hard work. And we hope that you are ready now, polishing your speeches for next week, the 20th. Okay.
Thank you, ma'am.
The meeting is adjourned until next week. We have NNR and NEXA. Before us.
That is before you go to the project. Maybe.